Jessica Ramos from Trade Unionist in Solidarity with Colombia summarized the struggle at the Coca-Cola bottling plants in Colombia.
We can no longer sit still. We can no longer keep quiet as we learn of the atrocities these men and women in Colombia are experiencing. Threats, kidnappings, tortures, and murders have taken place in response to unionization. We believe earning a living wage in order to provide ourselves and our families with food, shelter, and clothing is a human right, and we will stop at nothing to defend it.
Luis Adolfo Cardona witnessed the assassination of union contract negotiator Isidro Segundo Gil at the Carepa bottling plant in 1996, and he had to flee the country after paramilitaries attempted to kidnap him.
This Week in Radical History for the week starting February 9th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, and radical info can be found at the Daily Bleed website. Here's a tiny bit more about one radical struggle in Colombia. Thanks for listening.
I noticed the paramilitary had jumped back onto the motorcycle and were fleeing the scene. When I reached his body, I put my hands under his head. At that point, I realized that his head had come apart in my hands. My hands were covered in his blood. I noticed that his two young daughters rushed towards him, and now in his pool of blood were telling him, "Daddy, Daddy, wake up, don't leave us."
This week in Radical History for February 9th, 1886, President Cleveland declares a state of emergency in Seattle because of anti-Chinese violence. Since the disgraceful butchery of the Chinese in Wyoming several months ago, the anti-Chinese feeling in the extreme Northwest has become more violent and nearly universal. Following a declaration the Chinese are, quote, immoral and degraded and a constant menace to free institutions, to the home, and to the family. The Chinese were the Mexicans of their day. Now neo-Nazi skinheads are on the rise in this country and all over the world.
Hate crimes against Latinos have risen nearly 40% since 2003. The National Hispanic Media Coalition wants to know whether a spike in anti-Latino hate speech on TV and radio, coming not just from the fringes but well-known talkers like Michael Savage and Rush Limbaugh, is contributing to the violence. Last week, the group called upon the Federal Communications Commission to investigate the relationship between hate speech and hate crimes.
This is a national epidemic. The growth is spurred each day by hate speech, distortion of facts, and anti-immigrant sentiment expressed on cable shows, local radio shows, and across the airwaves. The serious topic of immigration has been contaminated by hatred and racism, and it's created a toxic climate which fosters and condones violence, all motivated by bigotry.
The more we forget our own history, the more horrors will be revisited. Also on February 9, 1917, San Francisco labor agitator Tom Mooney is falsely convicted of a fatal bombing. He is pardoned and released 22 and a half years later. Thomas Mooney's show trial was conducted in a lynch mob atmosphere and featured several witnesses whose testimony was coached by the prosecutor. It included one witness who claimed her astral body was at the scene. Also on February 9, 1982, President George Bush Sr. denies he ever used the phrase voodoo economics and challenges anybody to find it. NBC's Ken Doty promptly broadcast the 1980 tape in which he has said the phrase.
Does anyone know what Vice President Bush called this in 1980? Anyone? Something D-O-O economics. Voodoo economics. Voodoo economics. Voodoo economics. Voodoo economics. Anyone? Anyone?
Lastly, for February 9, 1994, a Senate report reveals the U.S. did ship biological agents, WMD, to Iraq with Reagan's approval. Just in case there's any debate about that.
Anyone? Anyone?
This week in Radical History for February 10, 1855. The Women's Hospital in New York City is founded. Although it did provide much-needed care for poor women, the hospital is also an arena for J. Marion Sims, known for his hatred of women and ruthlessly cutting up their bodies. Here he will perform brutal operations using indigent women as guinea pigs before audience of men. Sims began his career performing dangerous sexual surgeries on black slave women who were housed in a stable in his yard. On one particular slave, he performed 30 operations. After the affiliation with New York Women's Hospital, Sims performed the same number of operations on an Irish indigent Mary Smith. Internationally famous and honored by his peers, Sims was the object of adulation from the Harvard Medical School, counted as one of the immortals. I guess you can be immortal if you sold your soul to the devil.
Anyone? Anyone?
Also on February 10th, 1892 in Spain, four farm workers are executed during a repression following an uprising in January of Jerez, setting off a new wave of violence in Spain. Last month, hundreds of farm workers calling them a social revolution took over the town of Jerez. The insurrection was quickly subdued and leaders captured and tortured. Anarchists would fight a good fight for years in Spain, including in 1932, the anarcho-syndicalist NCT proclaimed general strike and more insurrections followed. Within the week, the Catalonia city of Teresa is taken over, and anarchist commune is declared. Two more items for February 10, 1961. The Voice of Nuclear Disarmament pirate radio station begins operating off the shores of England. Last Anna State in 1962. Francis Gary Powers, a CIA pilot in a super-secret U-2 airplane, is captured by the Russians. When the United States government learned that Powers disappeared over the Soviet Union, it issued a cover statement claiming that a weather plane had crashed down after a pilot had difficulties with his oxygen tank. What U.S. officials did not realize was the plane crashed almost fully intact, and the equipment was obviously not used for weather forecasting, since it was long-range telescoping lens that aimed down. After Powers had finally returned to the United States, he is criticized by his handlers for not using the CIA-issued suicide pin. I wonder if that suicide pin was the flag lapel pin on his jacket.
This is your radio roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, February 11th in 1916, black feminist and American civil rights activist Florence Kennedy was born in Kansas City, Missouri. Flo Kennedy began her career as a lawyer but quickly lost faith in the American judicial system and decided that practicing law might never be an effective means of changing society or resisting oppression. Flo turned to political activism and in 1966 set up an organization called the Media Workshop to fight racism in journalism and advertising. She continued her struggle for justice both in the courts and on the streets, aligning herself with movements from the Black Panther Party to abortion rights, and even publicly rallied against the Vietnam War. Flo's political activism extended in all directions, and one of her favorite mottos was that you have to fight on all the fronts, all the time. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also this week in Radical History, on February 11th, 1978, Longest Walk begins. 300 Native Americans start march from Alcatraz in San Francisco, California to Washington, D.C., organized by the American Indian Movement, AIM, to shine a light on the plight of indigenous peoples in America. Also on February 11, 1987, President Reagan tells the Tower Commission he did not approve arms sales to Iran, which was a lie. After the weapons sales were revealed in November of 1986, Ronald Reagan appeared on national television and stated that the weapons transfer he intended to occur, but the United States did not trade arms for hostages. The investigation was compromised when large volumes of documents relating to the scandal were destroyed or withheld from investigators by the Reagan administration officials. Same old, same old. Only two more items for February 11, 1990. South Africa political prisoner Nelson Mandela is released after 27 years in prison by the U.S.-supported apartheid government of South Africa. Also on the state in 2006, duck everybody duck. After a couple of noon toddies, Vice President Dick Cheney, armed and dangerous with a shotgun, peppers a millionaire contributor, shooting him in the face while bird hunting.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, February 12th, in 1853, Illinois passed a law stating that no black person from another state was allowed to stay in their state for more than 10 days. If they were caught, they were to be arrested and either subject to a $50 fine or temporarily auctioned into forced labor. These laws, known as black laws, were extremely common in the southern states, and the state of Illinois had particularly harsh tactics. Although Illinois entered the Union as a free state in 1818, slavery had existed there for almost 100 years and continued to exist for a long time. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on February 12, 1913, Mary Harris Mother Jones leads a protest of conditions in the West Virginia mines and is arrested. A government official once called Mary Jones the most dangerous woman in America. She was very dangerous to the establishment order because she was fearless in her defense of the oppressed working class. For 60 years, she went into mining towns where men often feared to go, organizing unions. The miners called her Mother Jones, and she is still out organizing up to the age of 83. This week in radical history for February 13th, 1633, Italian astronomer Galileo arrives in Rome before his trial of the Inquisition for professing beliefs that the Earth revolves around the Sun. Now, how silly can that be? Remember, the Pope is infallible. Also on February 13th, 1921, Peter Potemkin's funeral is held in Moscow. It would be the last public anarchist gathering and last non-state-sponsored mass assembly in Russia for 70 years, as Lenin, Trotsky, and the Bolsheviks begin a crackdown to secure their power over the working class. Under the pressure of libertarians and anarchists, prisoners were allowed to attend Potemkin's funeral. The crowd was estimated over 100,000, following the coffin to the cemetery. Black flags are deployed and banners proclaiming, "Where there is authority, there is no freedom." Also on February 13, 1945 in Germany, over 130,000 killed as the Allied firebombing of Dresden occurs. Remains little known event in today's history as the Allies downplay the slaughter of innocents. In a three-day period, 3,400 tons of explosives and incinerators were dropped, reducing 6 square miles of the city to rubble. Many Allied officials were outraged. Germany was clearly on the verge of collapse, and Dresden was not a German war production city. Dresden had been famous for its artworks and historical buildings until it became victim of the single most devastating air raid of World War II. Also on this date in 1967 in the United States, National Student Association reveals that it was secretly and indirectly receiving more than $3 million from the CIA over a 15-year period. NSA President Eugene Grove denies any money was used for intelligence work. Yeah, right. The funds given by the NSA were used in a variety of projects, all approved beforehand by CIA officials. As he told the New York Times, some of the information apparently was passed directly to the CIA employees, and some of it, in the course of normal business, went to the files of the NSA, to be later accessed by clandestine operations within the association. Those students have signed secrecy oaths with the CIA would then be bound by penalty of law to keep their knowledge of the ultimate benefactor from the public and the rest of their organization. CIA money, domestic spying. I think I've heard this before.
This is your Radio Works reporter, Hannah George. On this day, February 13th, in 1971, the Southeast Asian country of Laos was under severe attack by South Vietnam and the U.S., who encouraged and supported the invasion. Presenting a huge threat to American war interests, Laos played a key role in the Vietnam War. This war, commonly known as the Secret War, turned Laos into one of the most manipulated and exploited battlegrounds used between America and North Vietnam. The war left Laos in political disaster. Also, the Laotians who were recruited to help the U.S. became despised in Laos, and the U.S. left them at the end of the war in a very bad situation. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. Say it.
Lastly, for February 13, 1995, Chase Manhattan Bank distanced itself from a newsletter calling for Mexico to eliminate the Zapatista rebels in Mexico, according to the New York Times. The Chase Bank pointed to the uprising in Chiapas as a major element in the fight for foreign investors. Mexican security forces began a large-scale takeover of the former rebel areas on February 9th, less than a month after the memo was published. Mexican security forces engaged in widespread violation of human rights that continue to this day. The memo also suggested that the Mexican government might not find it convenient to honor the results of the upcoming elections. This uprising has boosted the price of the Mexican Indian blood, said by a man known as Subcomptos Marcos, who led the Zapatista National Liberation Army in Chiapas. Not long ago, it was valued less than 2 chickens. Now it is a condition of the largest loan in history, Subcomptos Marcos said, referring to the $40 billion loan proposed by the Clinton and his neoliberal friends.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, February 14th in 1804, New Jersey became the last northern state to abolish slavery. Actually, the legislation called for the gradual abolition of slavery, and it aimed to phase slavery out over a 25-year period. Ironically, the act granted financial benefits to slave owners. In the years since, New Jersey has built itself a rather bad reputation as far as racial discrimination and police brutality goes. The New Jersey state troopers are often accused of targeted racial profiling and violent tactics. The names Asada Shakur, Zaid Malik Shakur, and Sundiata Akolai come to mind. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Okay, coming close to the end of the show. This Week in Radical History, also for February 14th, 1895, Oscar Wilde's comedy, The Importance of Being Earnest, opens in London. A free thinker, Oscar once said, "Disobedience in the eyes of anyone who has read history is man's original virtue. It is through disobedience that progress has been made, through disobedience and through rebellion." Hear, hear, my man. Lastly, for February 14th, 1991, in Iraq, while the military and American press are gaga with their proclamations of precision bombing, U.S. warplanes bomb civilian shelter, killing at least 500 in Baghdad. Happy Valentine's Day from good old Uncle Sam. This week in Radical History for February 15th, I only have one item. 2003. Over 15 million people around the world in over 300 cities demonstrate in opposition to the American government's agenda to overthrow the government of Iraq through military invasion. Up to 2 million demonstrate in London, up to 3 million demonstrate in Rome, 1.3 million in Barcelona, 600,000 in Madrid, up to 500,000 in Berlin, 200,000 in Damascus, 200,000 plus protests in New York City, ringed by police snipers, 30,000 protests in Los Angeles, and about 25,000 hit the streets in Seattle, and over 1,000 in my small little hometown. All that effort, all that organizing did nothing. The voice of the people stopped nothing. And after the war started, most anti-war protesters stayed home. Yeah, that showed the Bush administration what's what. To quote MASH, "War never ends, they just take it on the road."
Defense Department regrets to inform you that your sons are dead because they were stupid.
This is also the end of This Week in Radical History for this week. Special thanks to WBAI in New York, whose audio I borrowed for this show. Little announcement here to let you know that by popular demand, I and Glee Glee Studios will be producing a 20-minute segment from time to time, consisting of more current alternative media reporting, looking at it from a more anarchical perspective. The show will be called Cannon's Report, and will be coming out from time to time, here and there, almost willy-nilly, let's say. Our goal is to shoot for once a week, but we have to see. Again, that's Cannon's Rapport, at the same place you can find this show each and every week, radioforall.net and the Pacifica Archives. Got to run. So until next time, whenever that might be, one thing is for sure. I am always and forever yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
This concludes our broadcast day.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. This week, our Palestinian voice is that of Sahar Francis, an attorney with Adamir, a Palestinian prison support and human rights advocacy organization. She spoke at the Harvard Law School, and we were there to record her presentation for This Week in Palestine. Here is the first-hand account of the stark realities of Palestinian life under Israeli military occupation. Here is Sahar Francis.
With Justice for Palestine, this is an organization dedicated to raising awareness about the Palestinian experience and the Palestinian struggle here at the law school. Today, we're joined by Sahar Francis, the general director of Damir Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association, which is a crucial Palestinian civil society organization based in Ramallah that does prisoners' rights and prisoner support. Damir has been around for 25 years, this year actually, and has faced incredible repression from the Israeli occupation authorities, from a lot of different sources, and it's really an incredible honor and a really special opportunity for us to meet with them here in person. So today's presentation is going to touch on topics including human rights, occupation, military law, military court systems, and specific mechanisms like administrative detention. So just briefly, administrative detention is basically a system. It's a holdover from the British Mandate period in historic Palestine, where you can be detained indefinitely without being presented with your charges against you, without being arraigned, without having a hearing or an opportunity to defend yourself, on the basis of secret evidence. And remember, it's indefinitely renewable. So this is just one example of the tools of the way in which the prison system is used as a social control on the Palestinian community. It's been used against elected officials like Hadid Lajarab, as well as student organizations like the Progressive Student Labor Front at Biazet. And Sahar will help us understand more of what our counterparts in Occupy Palestine are experiencing and provide some historical context and updates from the front lines of the struggle for Palestinian liberation. If you'd be interested in getting involved in events like this in the future, please do leave us your name on a sign-in sheet, which will be going around. And without further ado, please help me in welcoming Sahar Francis.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thanks for organizing this event. It's very, very interesting and important for me to meet law students today and to discuss actually how the occupation managed since 67 till today to use the law as a tool of oppression against a whole society and a tool of control. And this is what exactly the Palestinian prisoners' case and the military court system in the occupied territories reflects. Let me start with the point that the Israeli occupation forces, when they entered to the occupied territories, at the first 3 months, actually, they implemented the international humanitarian law, the Fourth Geneva Convention on the occupied territories. But very soon after, they changed their minds and they started to implement their own military orders And they established their own military court system that is still controlling every aspect of our life under the occupation. So they made the military governor the legislator. So all these military orders are coming from the military governor who controls the occupied territories. They established the military court system, and they established a civil system, a civil administration system, in order to deal with all the daily civil issues like registering newborns and getting permits to work inside Israel, to travel abroad, to build your house, and to register your land, and all other civil aspects, which wasn't supposed to take place because the occupiers are not supposed to become the, like to replace the state in the occupied territories and to have jurisdiction all over these civil issues, unless if it's very needed for the development and for the interest of the local people, which the Israelis totally violated in their military system. So immediately they started to issue these military orders. Today they are 1,700 military orders. They automatically illegalized any political party in Palestine that was existing, that was supposed to be established. So today, any political party in Palestine is declared illegal, still including Fatah, the main party of the PLO that signed the Oslo Agreement back in 1993. So theoretically, they can arrest the president himself, Abbas, for being the head of the Fatah party. This is correct as well inside Israel. All studential movements in Palestine are illegal because all these student movements are associated with the political parties. So being a student activist in any university, like Colin said for the Beer Zeit University, it's not just that it could subject you for administrative detention. You could be imprisoned for 1 year, 2 years, if you are active under the like Qutb, the left union for the left groups in the university, or the Islamic Jihad, or the Hamas group. Any civil humanitarian aid or charitable organizations that the Israelis claim that they are affiliated with political parties would be declared illegal. And this has happened a lot after 2000, after the Second Intifada. Hundreds of charitable organizations were declared illegal in order to affect their humanitarian aid and their work with the community. They interfered in the health sector, in the education sector, in every aspect of our daily life in order to control our life. We started with five different military courts in the occupied territories. Currently, there's just two, because after the Oslo Agreement, you know, they withdrawled from the main cities in the Palestinian occupied territories, but they are still controlling more than 62% of the occupied territories. And these two military courts actually focusing not just on the security cases. You know that according to the international law, they have the right as occupiers to have military court system and to prosecute civilians and militant people under the occupation if they are involved in very security threatening cases that immediately cause a huge threat to the forces of the occupation. But the jurisdiction of the military court is much wider beyond this strict definition by the international law. Geographically, the military courts have extrajudicial jurisdiction. So any Palestinian or international that commits any violation according to these military orders outside the occupied territories, he could be arrested and prosecuted for these acts. So many students who went to study in Russia or in Pakistan, in Sudan, in Yemen, in any other country, and came back, they were subjected for imprisonment because of their involvement in these universities in these countries. as threatening. There is a crime that it's actually very wide, threatening the security of the area. We call it, this is the basket crime that can fit inside any activity that they claim based on secret information that you caused a serious threat to the security of the area. There's no clear definition what it means, the areas, and what it means, the security of the area. Actually, by this system, also there's like the most problematic issue for me as a lawyer working in this system for 20 years is the definition of the crimes and how they submit the charge sheet, the language of the activities that they describe. It's very vague. For example, throwing stones. They never put in the factual part of the charge sheet when you throw the stones, exact time, where, exact place, so you can defend yourself properly. You can argue that I wasn't there, I was with my family, I was with my friends in that place, and so on. Also, as I said, it includes almost every aspect of our daily life. It's not just defining the most security serious cases. So journalists would be arrested, political leaders, students, children, like even teachers in the universities were subjected for imprisonment, Palestinian Legislative Council members, and so on. Currently, there are 6,150 prisoners in the Israeli prisons, but in all these 50 years, more than 750,000 Palestinians were arrested, which means you cannot find any Palestinian house that they were not experiencing the imprisonment at least once against one family member. In some cases, you can find five people from the same house arrested in the same time. Out of these 6,000, still there's 300 children under detention and 460 administrative detainees, 62 female prisoners, and 11 Palestinian Legislative Council members, and 9 of them, they are under administrative detention. In order to explain more how they use it as an act of control, so for example, in the first Intifada, when all these demonstrations and peaceful resistance started, very massive in all of the Palestinian villages, immediately the mass arrest campaign started, and they started to use a lot the administrative detention. So in the first Intifada, more than 10,000 people were arrested under administrative detention. Most of those were like activists on the ground, initiating demonstrations and organizing the neighborhood committees that they were taking care about the daily life of the people under the first Intifada in the OPT. So these military orders that, as Colin said, came from the British Mandate security regulations were developed later on in the Israeli system and in the military system and were adjusted as local law based on a secret information. Any military governor can arrest anyone for up to 6 months claiming that you are a threat to the security. So the only suspicious that you would be getting in this order as a written document is that you are a threat to the security, nothing more than that. You wouldn't know at all what's the kind of activities, what's the proofs, and so on. So you have to defend yourself against something that actually you don't know what it is exactly about. And it could be renewed indefinitely. There's no limit how many times they can renew this 6 month order. It applies for children. Currently, there's one child under administrative detention. In 2010, they arrested 25 children under administrative detention. And it could be used against everyone. For the first time in 2015, they used it in East Jerusalem as well against children. Since the beginning of the occupation, they never used administrative detention against children, but they did. They arrested five children from East Jerusalem in 2015, 2016 for up to 6 months under administrative detention. The longest period, continuous period that a Palestinian detainee spent in administrative detention was 8 years. So you should know that also sometimes they keep you 4 years, 5 years, they release you for 4 months, 5 months, and they re-arrest you. We have cases that people so far spent 13 years and 15 years in and out. And in all this period, maybe they spent 2 years outside of the prison without knowing when you would be released and what you are supposed to do in order to put an end for such harassment. The administrative detention as well could be used in the same time of the prosecution. I'll give an example of one of our, the media officer of Al-Damir, Hassan Safadi, that currently is under administrative detention. Hassan was arrested in the 1st of May 2015. After he came back, 2016, sorry, he was visiting, he was attending the Social World Forum in Tunisia, and he was coming back to the occupied territories when he was arrested. He was under interrogation for 31 days. Then they decided to prosecute him for his visit a year before to Lebanon, because Lebanon is an enemy state, according to the Israeli laws. So any Israeli or any Palestinian resident of East Jerusalem, because they have the permanent residency, they cannot visit Lebanon. This is what they claimed. They accused him of visiting an enemy state. When they submitted the charge sheet, we managed to release Hassan on conditions. One of the conditions was paying a bill of 5,000 shekels. So his father went to pay the money. In the same time, they issued administrative detention order to keep Hassan in detention, because they failed based on this accusation to keep him in detention. So they used the administrative detention. We ended up, Hassan was under two different procedures. He was under 6 months of administrative detention and facing a trial in the same time. At the end, for this crime, he was convicted for 3 months imprisonment, which he already spent while he's spending the 6 months of administrative detention. But his administrative detention was extended twice. So he spent 1 year and a half. He's supposed to be released in the 8th of December 2017. This is how it works. This is how they use the system, actually, in order to affect. And at the end of the day, all what was Hassan involved in is sharing in different conferences in the name of Al-Damir. This is also reflects how they try to undermine our work as human rights organizations. Maybe in our case, they cannot declare that Al-Damir is an illegal organization, because on the level of the funds and the relations, they cannot prove that we are affiliated with any entity, and it's clear where we get our funds. They cannot claim we are getting funds from terrorist organizations. So this is why they use other techniques. They raided the office in 2012, stole 5 computers, 2 cameras, and destroyed most of our files. And then they arrested the legal assistants for 10 months in administrative detention, Hassan for 1 year and a half. Now the other field researcher in Jerusalem, Salah Hammouri, is under 6 months of administrative detention. Khalida Jarrar, that used to be the ex-director of Al-Damir as well, and now she's a Palestinian Legislative Council member and a board member in Al-Damir, is under 6 months of administrative detention. 26 journalists were arrested this year, most of them under administrative detention. So also the way how it's very easy legally to arrest people under this system enables them to arrest hundreds and thousands. Even in the time of Oslo, they used administrative detention. They arrested 850 activists in the Oslo time that they were opposing Oslo from the opposition side under administrative detention. Some of them spent 4 years in administrative detention. Later on, in the Second Intifada, before the Second Intifada started in September 2000, we had 4 administrative detainees immediately in the first month, it jumped to be 40. Then in the first 3 months, it's started to increase. We ended up in 2002, in March 2002, with 2,500 administrative detainees. Like in March 2002, when they reoccupied the Palestinian cities, in less than 2 weeks, they arrested 15,000 men, Palestinian men, from all of the cities. They kept most of them at least for 3 months in order to figure whether these people could be accused, whether they want to use administrative detention, and so on. And then, for example, Aufer, one of the main detention facilities now in the occupied territory, it's very close to Ramallah, but they deal with it as part of East Jerusalem, so they enforce the families to get permits to reach Aufer, still even if it's physically in the occupied territories. It was hosting more than 1,500 detainees in very, very bad conditions because it wasn't a prison. Aufer at that time was just a military base for vehicles, was prepared for hosting tanks and military vehicles. So because they arrested 15,000 people, they didn't know where to put them. They started to use Aufer, and they held 750 people each in the garage of the tanks in March in Palestine. It's very similar weather to here. And it was very horrible conditions for at least 3 months. When all the human rights organizations started to petition the High Court to try to develop the conditions. Going back to the... I'm sorry, there's lots of details to discuss about the issue of the military court systems, and I know most of you are not so familiar with such a system, and we cannot enter in all of these legal details about the procedures, the fair trial standards, and how it's contradicting the international standards, but I would just make a bit comparison in order for you to understand a bit how it works and how it's actually causing discriminating policies between the Palestinian local community and the settlers who are in the occupied territories or any other Israeli that would be arrested for the same reasons under the civil system. So in the military court system, it started with totally different procedures when it comes for the length of arrest under interrogation, comparing to the international standards and the Israeli standards on the length of the trial itself and the sentences and so on, and also the procedures themselves. First, you should know that we have two different legal systems in the same place. Like settlers who live in the occupied territories are not subjected to the military courts I'm describing. If they commit any crime, even against a Palestinian, like killing a Palestinian, they would be brought to inside Israel to be prosecuted according to the Israeli criminal system and not according to the military system. So by itself, there's an apartheid policy from the beginning in differentiating between these two communities. According to the military orders, up to 2012, actually, they were enabled to arrest anyone for up to 8 days without any judicial review. 8 days, you can stay in the detention facility. They can do whatever they want till you reach the judge after 8 days. Where in Israel, it was 24 hours always. According to the international standards, the shortest, the better, to bring someone for judicial review about the initial order to arrest someone. It was also applying for children. They were having children for up to 8 days without any judicial review. Just on 2012, they started to change. Now it's 4 days. Still for children that they are more than 14 years old, it's 4 days. Those who are less than 14, it's 48 hours. But it could be still extended for like 69 hours. Where in Israel, for children less than 14, it's 12 hours that they should be brought to the judicial review. The length, the total period of interrogation, it used to be 6 months. In 2012, they made it 75 days before submitting the charge sheet, but it could be extended up to 6 months again. But first it was 90 days plus another 90 days, another 90 days. Now it's 75 and it could be extended, where in Israel it's 30 days. In the security cases, like the dangerous cases, it's 35 days, and it could be renewed for up to 60 days, but not 6 months definitely. The ban on lawyer visit. You should know that all this period under interrogation, you can spend without any legal counseling under the military orders, because it's enabling them to ban a lawyer visit for up to 60 days. Almost the most important period of the interrogation you can spend without getting any counseling on your rights in this sensitive period. And of course, these interrogations take place in Hebrew, sometimes in Arabic. Mostly the statements would be written in Hebrew, a language that the Palestinian prisoners, especially the children, they don't read, don't understand, and they would be enforced to sign a statement that it's not in their own language. Then we have to fight in the court about the accuracy of this statement, and in most of the cases it would be dismissed because the interrogators would claim, we speak Arabic, we translated every word for the child or the adult in Arabic, and he signed, he understood what we wrote in this statement. Of course, under interrogation, there's lots of different forms of torture. In the 70s, 80s, it was very physical, severe torture. Then it developed to be more psychological. Still, they use very different forms of tying in very painful positions, sleep deprivation. Of course, the families are not allowed to visit at all in the time of the interrogation, and so on. So after finishing the interrogation period, you would be facing either charges or you would be sent for administrative detention. It's very rare that you would be released without anything. The level of convictions in the military court, it's 97.4.9 something percent. So it's mostly all of the cases would end up in plea bargain because the detainees wouldn't have trust that they can argue these cases in the, like, they don't expect justice in such a system. So they prefer to plead bargain in order to plead guilty in order to be sure what's the kind of sentence they would be getting and how long, and that's it. And to save all this horrible experience of the transfer back and forth for the trial procedures that can take 2 years, up to 18 months, and it could be extended, while in Israel it's 9 months where the trial should end. So in the military court, it could be ended without any end, actually, and then you can spend 2 years, 3 years back and forth in the buses and suffering from very bad conditions in the tour from the prison to the court, and so on. So this is one element why they choose to go for a deal with the prosecution and just to spend the imprisonment in the prison, and that's it. Actually, in the last couple of years, they tried to make some changes on the military courts, but we claim this is just for public relations because there was lots of condemnation about these military court systems, especially against children. It's not offering protection and a real protection, neither for the children, neither for the adults in this system. So children, for example, up to 2012, they were defined as 16 years old. All those that they were more than 16, till 2012, they were treated totally as adults. Nothing special in their trial, in their interrogation, or anything. It didn't make a big difference when they increased the age to be 18 now, and they have a special court for military court for children, but it's not following the procedures according to the international law for child rights and the protections that it should offer. So, for example, there's no rehabilitation programs. The only sentence would be real custodial imprisonment in the military courts. They don't send a child for a closed center for rehabilitation to like help him to spend these 2 years or 1 year instead of spending them in a regular prison and the rehabilitation. It's not different procedures. Still, they face the same military court procedures, even though just the only thing that they are separated now from the adults and the court hearing is closed, so there's no public there. So this is the only protection they offer, that no one would know about your case but just your family. But they are still getting the same sentences and the same treatment. The new thing, what happened in 2016 in the Israeli civil system for children cases, that they changed the military, the civil law. Before 2016 in Israel was, if you are a child under 14 and you committed the crime while you were under 14, you will never get a custodial imprisonment as a sentence. Any sentence would be just under a rehabilitation or police officer follow-up and so on, but not real imprisonment. After all these clashes took place in East Jerusalem and in other places and involving children with stabbing and other issues, they changed the law, and today they can arrest any child that he's under 14 if he committed one of three crimes, like killing, attempt to kill, and attacking in serious circumstances, and they can send him even for life sentences. And this is what happened with the case of Ahmed Manasra. Actually, Ahmed Manasra was the first boy. They changed the law after the case of Ahmed Manasra, but it was because of his case. He was less than 14. They claimed that he was involved in attempt to kill case, and they couldn't arrest him for life sentence. So they kept him in detention till the end of the trial. At the end, he was sentenced for 12 years, and he's spending now the 12 years. So then they changed the law. It's very easy to change the laws in order to adjust them to their own interest, in order how to make it more difficult. Because in this law, the child should have a motivation, like for the activity he did. And of course, it's an ideological motivation. So you can understand that it's just applicable for Palestinians. Because Israeli Jewish boys, they would never have such an ideological motivations behind their throwing stones or attacking Palestinians and so on. So this is the hidden policy, how the law itself would be drafted in a language that it seems to be objective, but at the end of the day, there is something that enables to be implemented just for certain group, as so many other laws in the Israeli, either definitely in the civil system. I would just end with the issue of the hunger strike a little bit about what happened this year, because it was a significant issue for the prisoners' case in 2017. They were involved in a hunger strike of 41 days, demanding their own basic rights inside the prison. One of these basic demands was phone calls. So all of these Palestinian political prisoners are not allowed to use the phone while in prison to contact their families. So if they are not permitted family visits for security reasons, even if it's for 10 years or 15 years that you don't get family visits, you also are not allowed to phone your family, to have any contact with your family. So one of the demands was the phone calls, the health care, the education. Palestinian prisoners are not allowed to study and to continue studying in any of the universities, neither the Israeli Open University or any of the Palestinian universities, or the crowded conditions and so many other daily life issues. Immediately when they initiated their hunger strike, the Israelis were totally against and they were refusing to negotiate with the prisoners. It ended up just with promises that we will develop the conditions. Unfortunately, till today, it wasn't reaching any good improvement in the basic things that they were demanding. And hunger strike in the last couple of years was used a lot by the prisoners, whether individually, demanding the end of administrative detention, basically. Currently, there's one detainee that he's still launching his own hunger strike against administrative detention for the third week, and collectively as a movement against the conditions of the prisons. Sometimes it succeeds, sometimes not. Depends a lot as well about the support from the community, from the international level, from the Palestinian Authority and other official level like European Union or the UN and so on. In 2012, for example, it was more success, hunger strike, because these groups were more supportive on the international level and they interfered, like the European Parliament and the Arab League as well. And it ended up with negotiations led by Egypt, for example, which this time didn't work in the same way. I'm giving this example to reflect how it's the people and the mobilization of the people that can make a huge difference for the issue of the prisoners in supporting their causes. And just to remind you that on the child issues, I'm sure you heard about the campaign No Way to Treat a Child that was last week, like a Congress woman here initiated a bill for the Congress requesting that there should be more like investigation in the fund that the United States gives to Israel, whether this fund is used to arrest children or not. And they're requesting to stop if this fund is used in some way in this system against the child detainees, so it should be stopped because it's a grave violation for the human rights and international humanitarian law. And I think this is a very, of course, we don't expect that this bill would be approved, but at least this is opens the discussion in such a high level about the rights of these children and, of course, about the military system and so on. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Sahar Francis, an attorney with Adamir, the Palestinian Prisoner Support and Human Rights Organization. Her presentation was followed by a question and answer period, and time will allow only for the handling of one question, but it is a very significant question and a beautifully crafted answer. The question comes from an Israeli student at the Harvard Law School, who had experience working in the Israeli legal system, including the Israeli Supreme Court. The question is from an Israeli occupier perspective. The answer is from the Palestinian occupied perspective, an example of the stark realities the people of the region face every day. First, the Israeli student's question, and then Sahar Francis's answer.
Thank you so much for your presentation. My name is Ayelet. I'm from Israel, and I worked in the Supreme Court for 2 years, and I also worked in government. And I know a lot of the problems you're talking about, and I do agree that administrative detention is a very problematic tool. I've seen it very closely. But I do feel that to some extent, there you should also note that we are talking a lot of the times about terrorist actions. And we're talking about political organizations and how they are illegal, but we're talking also about Hamas as a political organization. And personally, when I had a lot to do with reviewing these administrative detentions, and I think Israeli authorities are really trying, and I see in the Supreme Court there are a lot of cases, like you say, maybe too many, but still, that are looking into the evidence and seeing if this is necessary or not. This is a tool that in a place in which we are dealing with terrorism, that is the way to deal with. I think also in Israel, and I've been doing a lot of human rights work also, there are tries to diminish the bad effects of it, but still it is a tool that is needed sometimes. And also a lot of the investigation methods that you mentioned were banned a long time ago by the Supreme Court. Maybe the tying and the sleeping restrictions. And I know that sometimes there are claims that this is happening, and still the Supreme Court is very active in trying to diminish this. I do think that there it should just be noted, and also Israelis can be in administrative detention. I know it's not the same numbers, but still, I feel like it's a
huge difference of numbers. Allow me to reflect on this, please, because I think in the last 10 years of the High Court history, no one single petition of one Palestinian administrative detainee was accepted. And I'm guaranteeing this. It's also what happens there, also a deal, like the security would come and suggest for the detainee, accept another order, and this would be the last order. This is how we end cases in the High Court. You should know that in these years, not more than 4 Israelis, 1 or 2 of them were Palestinian Israelis, were subjected of administrative detention inside Israel. One of them is a settler that he was for 9 months. When he was released, he was requesting compensation from the state, and he got it for the administrative detention. So it's not really clear, correctly to say that the High Court is objective. No, it's not. I'm presenting in the High Court, and I see how they review. The secret information is the magic word for even the Israeli High Court. And if we want to talk about terrorism, I don't think even Hamas, as a political party, and all the Palestinian political parties, they have a political branch that have the right to work and to act in the Palestinian society as a political, like we were signing an agreement to become a state. So we have the right to establish our own political system. This is, of course, not undermining our right as a Palestinians under the international law to resist the occupation. And this is not terrorism. So we also disagree about the terminology, about what terrorism should be defined. I totally agree that there were maybe crimes committed by Palestinians under the international law that could be prosecuted in military courts, but the Israelis expanded much beyond this clear definition of the international law. So when Israel decides to arrest 48 parliamentarians from the Palestinian parliament in 2007, in order to paralyze totally the Palestinian parliament, this is not fighting terrorism. This is clear interfere in the political life of the Palestinian people, of the self-determination, of the right of the people to decide who's the representatives of the Palestinian people in every level, in the internal level and the international level. This is not about fighting terrorism.
And there you have it. Sarhar Francis of Adamir speaking at the Harvard Law School. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
We want. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we spend the hour discussing the media fighting fake news. We're joined by Dr. Rob Williams of the Action Coalition of Media Education to discuss critical media literacy in an age of digital disorientation. We'll also speak with journalist Abby Martin, host of the Empire Files on Telesur and Media Roots about media propaganda. We'll hear dispatches from her recent trip to Venezuela. We'll also hear from Project Censored's Associate Director, Dr. Andy Lee Roth, about our newest book, Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World, just out on Seven Stories Press. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we spend the hour doing what we oft do here at the Project Censored Show, looking at the media. Today, we're going to be talking about fighting fake news in an age of digital disorientation. We're joined first by Dr. Rob Williams. He's a professor at the University of Vermont, founding president of the Action Coalition for Media Education. He is the author of the recent book, Most Likely to Secede, What the Vermont Independence Movement Can Teach Us About Reclaiming Community and Creating a Human-Scale Vision for the 21st Century. He's also co-editor with Julie Frechette of Media Education for a Digital Generation. Additionally, Rob Williams is a contributor to Project Censored and also on the board of our collective efforts at the Global Critical Media Literacy Project. You can learn more at gcml.org. Rob Williams, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
So good to be with you and Peter, Mickey.
It's fantastic to have you on, as always, Rob. And as usual, our planets align. We talk about off-air about some things that you've been working on that directly correlate to what Andy Lee Roth and I have been working on in the next Project Censored book, Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World. And you've been working on an article called Fighting Fake News in an Age of Digital Disorientation, Towards Real News, Critical Media Literacy Education, and Independent Journalism for the 21st Century Citizens. And again, couldn't have more of a crossover with what we're all doing here. So, Rob, let's just kick it off and talk about, you know, where are you going with this piece and how does this dovetail with your work of late?
Really, the goal is to marry critical media literacy education, which we've been doing for a long time at ACME, with independent journalism, which, of course, dovetails beautifully with the work that Project Censored and GCMLP have been doing for a long time, particularly Project Censored. And we've been reviving Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman's five-filter propaganda model of news, which I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with, really charted in their book Manufacturing Consent back in the, I think it was 1987 when the book first came out. 1988. And in that book, of course, in the propaganda model of news, Chomsky and Herman posited a five-filter model through which all news and information has to pass in the U.S. so-called news and information culture before it saw the light of day, before it made its way to readers and viewers and what have you. And what's so fascinating now, of course, living in the digital age, or the age of digital disorientation, is the challenge of sort of updating that filter-driven propaganda model of news for the digital age. And what I proposed in this book chapter that we're working on right now and in some of the work we're doing at Vermont Independent and here at the University of Vermont in Burlington is updating this filter model. And we've added five filters for the digital age.
Let's talk about that in a moment. You start, of course, you know, George Seldes' great quote, journalism's job is not impartial, balanced reporting. Journalism's job is to tell the people what's really going on. Yeah. And when you're talking about adding to the list in our upcoming book here, Censored 2018, Edward Herman contributed a chapter on the propaganda model. And so, again, great dovetailing and symbiotic work going on here. And before we get into the additional filters and things that you're talking about, what do you mean by age of digital disorientation?
It's probably best captured in something a bewildered reporter said early in the year, right after Inauguration Day, in response to yet another sort of tweet storm from Donald Trump. He said, "What does Donald Trump mean when he uses words? What does Donald Trump mean when he says words?" And I just thought that was like the funniest and most telling sort of journalistic moment of the year so far.
Not only post-truth president, but postmodern.
Like, we're so far down kind of the postmodern rabbit hole in the, as encapsulated by this one sentence, that words themselves have lost all sort of ability to anchor us in a shared reality. And there's a big argument, I think, to be made that that's exactly how sort of creeping fascism, totalitarianism work. It's about unmooring people and putting them off balance, about disorienting people, regardless of their party or their politics or what have you, keeping people in sort of a perpetual state of disorientation. I think that's what we're witnessing right now. And everyone here in Vermont is really kind of scratching their head going, what is going on? Where are our anchors to a common reality?
It's as if we're in the eye of the Twitter storm. It's like scandal fatigue. Every time one turns around, I mean, and it's as if the media has been dragged and sucked into the morass that they helped create in the first place.
That's exactly right. And I think we're all in agreement that Trump is a symptom of a much larger, deeper, and older historical problem, which is this problem of how power is exercised in a heavily mediated age by corporations and governments who use these kinds of disorienting propagandistic moves to keep everybody off balance and keep everybody from organizing.
Well, indeed, in an era of fake news, alternative facts, post-truth, I mean, again, this has sort of been the riff and the theme that we've been dealing with here all year on several talks. We'll get into that here momentarily. Peter?
It seems that we're reaching this era, and of certainly digital media contributes to that, where people are so used to simply entertainment, all news becomes hyper-real, and that people just don't know what to believe anymore, and almost, in fact, can't have a reality because of the contradictions. You know, I mean, during the campaign, it was Hillary's progressive, which is a huge contradiction. Or we have to go to war with Russia, or Venezuela's a dictatorship. All of these are lies. You know, or North Korea is ready to destroy San Francisco. These are lies, but because there's so much of this propaganda inside of corporate media and digital media today, you don't know what's real anymore.
I think that's right, Peter, and I think it's really the perfect marriage of the Huxleyan warning that we are amusing ourselves to death, as Neil Postman famously said, a kind of a marriage of the Huxleyan warning with the Orwellian warning, which is the power of Big Brother with a capital B and a capital B in the form of state-driven or deep state-driven propaganda to completely disorient people. And I think that's what we're seeing right now. It's not an either-or phenomenon. It's a both-and, a Huxley and Orwell combined kind of crazy disorienting phenomenon.
Indeed, and it keeps coming up over and over again. And, you know, going back to such classic works like you mentioned, whether it's Huxley, Orwell, Postman, or in between even Orwell in terms of the politics of the English language, extraordinary reliance on euphemisms. And now it's in terms of that reality, we know about euphemisms and George Carlin's rants on that. But now we've gone even further, jumped the shark to alternative facts. It's beyond confirmation bias. Confirmation bias is where we go out and look for something that's factual that supports our view only. But now we live in a culture where from the top down, it's being modeled that you can manufacture material or evidence, or my ignorance is just as good as your knowledge and facts. That is extraordinarily destructive to any democratic culture. And you and I also agree, I'm sure, on this point, because this is one of our mainstays, certainly through the Global Critical Media Literacy Project, through ACME, Project Censored. And that's the importance of critical media literacy education is the antidote to the onslaught of fake news and alternative facts in a post-truth world.
That's exactly right, Mickey.
So talk to us about that. Rob Williams, University of Vermont, talk to us about more of the critical media literacy education component, particularly as you're outlining in your chapter with your additional filters.
We're really in the business, I think, of providing citizens with kind of three broad arenas, if you will. One is greater knowledge, and I think historical knowledge is deeply lacking. I would start there. Second would be skills, the kinds of skills of access, of media analysis, of media evaluation, of media criticism, media production in the digital age to really combat this digital disorientation. And then thirdly would be an activist sensibility, or if the term activist is too radical for some, a sense of civic engagement, that we want citizens to be involved in projects larger than themselves designed to make their worlds a better place for more people and the planet. So it's really about knowledge, number one, skills, number two, and activism, number three. And everything that we do, I think, in critical media literacy circles drives towards those three overlapping goals. The other thing to say about critical media literacy education is that we're fiercely independent when it comes to our funding and the networks that we build. A lot of media education in the United States and globally is, shall we say, massaged by corporations and governments who have, of course, their own agendas.
Back to the propaganda model.
Well, that's right. We're trying to carve out an independent space separate from government, separate from corporations, where we can cultivate this sensibility, this critical media literacy sensibility with people of all ages, not just students and universities, colleges, K through 12 schools, but also, I think, thinking adults who are as bewildered and disoriented by a lot of this stuff as our young people are.
Rob, you used the word global, and I'd like to pick up on that, because we really are talking about global media today. And I'm referring to Lee Art's book, The Global Entertainment Media, where he looks at MSNBC and CBS and ABC and those. They're all transnational. Disney is 150 countries. This is a global media project now. In many cases, it's coming from transnational capital. That is, it's not just the U.S. anymore. It is a global capitalist project to protect capitalism and to protect the privacy of corporations and the military in their adventures to allow capital flow anywhere in the world. That's the entertainment model of where we are today. So all of this power concentrated in less than, you know, 0.001% of the world's population, the multi-billionaires and millionaires, and that's what corporate media is today. It's owned and run by these mega wealthy people using those filters to control us and get us to behave and to consume and to believe in the rightfulness of capitalism to be anywhere in the world. It's totally a controlling, entertaining media.
That's right, Peter. And you've done some pioneering work on the transnational capitalist class. And I think part of our job in the critical media literacy education arena, a big part of it, is to connect the dots between what you just talked about with the transnational capitalist class and the way in which that particular group of people, that network of people, massage our so-called news, information, and entertainment digital media platforms for maximum messaging benefit to them. I think that's absolutely right.
I'd like to remind listeners, you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking with Dr. Rob Williams, University of Vermont, on the board at the Action Coalition for Media Education, as well as the Global Critical Media Literacy Project. Rob is co-editor most recently of a book called Media Education for a Digital Generation, co-edited with another friend of ours, Julie Frischette. And Rob, let's go into defining some of these other terms that you're getting at in a piece that you're working on in an age of digital disorientation. Before we get into fake news, let's define real news.
There's a big conversation about what constitutes real news. But for me, real news has six key simple characteristics. Number one, it's recent. Number two, it's relevant, by which we mean to say it's much talked about in the culture. Number three, it's reliable, which means you can tap into the sources from which that story comes from and recognize their authenticity and their accuracy. Number four, real news is about foregrounding power relations, what some call hegemony or hegemonic relations. Real news also, I think, has multiple points of view. And finally, real news is about historicizing the story. So much of what we get, what passes for news, quote unquote, in our culture right now is completely devoid of any sort of historical or hegemonic context. What the great writer, he worked out your way in California, Wallace Stegner, for many decades called the amputated present. So much of our news is kind of trapped in the amputated present that has no connection to the past. It has no connection really to the future. It kind of washes over us, and then, you know, we're on to the next story. So those are the six ingredients that in our mind, comprise realness.
Well, Rob Williams, fellow history professor here as well, I teach a whole critical reasoning course that looks at the intersection of past and present as a roadmap for the future and looks at the propaganda of historical construction, which deals directly with looking at propaganda model and filters and these very definitions that we're getting at. So now let's talk about the phenomenon of fake news. There's many definitions. You know, a decade ago, fake news was a satire like Stephen Colbert. But fake news is literally manufactured false information and propaganda is very old. And the current iteration of fake news is it's been weaponized to allow people to dismiss things with which they disagree. Talk to us a little bit about how you see fake news.
The term fake news is used in a bunch of different ways. One is to dismiss any argument or counter-argument that you or your party or your group of people or your stakeholder simply don't agree with. Fake news can also be used to demonize an entire network or channel or platform, which I think is incredibly dangerous, actually. And when I talk with my students about this phenomenon, I said, look, Some of you grow up in a culture where you think everything on Fox News is complete and utter Others of you grow up in a news culture where you think everything on MSNBC or Democracy Now or left-leaning news channel is complete But really, you have to take news stories, so-called news stories, one at a time and really unpack them and look at the definition of real news.
Each story, each time, right?
That's right. I mean, if you're a so-called left-leaning politically, you know, even Fox News is going to run a story that's going to be of interest and maybe accurate. For example, when they interviewed Julian Assange last election cycle in the fall from the Ecuadorian embassy outside of London, in which he gave sort of an extensive interview in which he talked about his own motivations and WikiLeaks motivations for releasing the 5,000 Podesta emails, et cetera. That was kind of a scoop for Fox, actually. It was kind of interesting. And no other national news source in the U.S. anyway was willing to touch that. And, you know, of course, Fox was not huge Hillary Clinton fans and what have you. So they were happy to run the Julian Assange interview. But it was a really fascinating, I thought, incredible interview, whether you like Assange's politics or not. So that's an example.
So, Rob Williams, we only have a few minutes left in this segment, and we wanted to make sure we got to your addition to the Chomsky-Herman media films from the propaganda model. And, of course, our listeners or listeners of this program know that it includes ownership and advertising as well as reliance on official sources as newsmakers, flack as well, or negative criticism. There's also a built-in ideological kind of bias through capitalism and markets and so forth. But you have added five others that I think are very significant. And could you run through these briefly?
You named the first five. The sixth filter, and that is what I call the deep state disinformation filter. There's a lot to say about the deep state, but certainly we know that for decades now, the deep state, the Central Intelligence Agency, and other networked agencies within it have been massaging so-called U.S. news and information networks in all kinds of ways. So that's a sixth filter. The seventh filter is the algorithmic filter, in which these very powerful for-profit media corporations like Google, Facebook, Twitter, Amazon create and code these platforms. And these are designed, of course, to serve up information in ways that they deem best. The eighth filter is a term coined by MoveOn founder Eli Pariser called filter bubble. We digital media users, through our selective content and platform choices, determine the reality that surrounds us in the so-called filter bubble, and we need to sort of fight against that and push outside of the realm of our bubbles. I think that's really important. The ninth filter, wonderful phrase, behavioral micro-targeting. And this surfaced during the election last fall when we saw Cambridge Analytica, based in London, talk about massaging 220 million American voters with 5,000 pieces of individual data on each of them through a lot of these digital media platforms in the months and weeks prior to the election. It's hard to know how accurate and how much reach this organization has with behavioral micro-targeting, but suffice to say, I think it played more of a role in massaging electoral outcomes than people realize. So we need to look at that as a filter because it's pretty prevalent. And it's coming on. And then finally, my favorite, the 10th filter, is what we call sock puppets. And these are fake and often anonymous social media accounts that are unleashed into digital and social media spaces from corporations or governments designed to attack or support particular ideas, candidates, positions, platforms, campaigns. Some of your listeners may be familiar with the TV show Homeland. But there's a whole interesting subplot in the latest season of Homeland that had to do with the CIA and a secret sock puppet office that was kind of at work behind the scenes on social media, really trying to game the outcome. So those are the five new filters that we have proposed that we think about when we think about the propaganda model of news for the digital age.
Indeed, Rob Williams, and we agree, as you write, our best solution to fighting fake news and fomenting real news is an interdisciplinary one with the teaching of critical thinking, history, writing, and multimedia production at its core. And, of course, at Global Critical Media Literacy Project, Project Censored, ACME, so many of us in this community really working toward this. And, you know, now is really our time to shine, I think, Rob Williams. And now I believe our work is more important than ever, particularly given the last five filters that we are inundated with in this age of digital disorientation. Rob Williams, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show today. We will certainly be revisiting these topics, and we'd love to have you back on the air to talk about them more specifically in the near future.
Mickey and Peter, thanks for your work, and we'll talk again soon.
After this brief musical break, we will return to the Project Censored Show in an interview with Abby Martin. Stay with us.
Welcome to the holy city, a silver screen, built with a lens and a low self-esteem. A teenager's plea for meaning and means, we're selling the news. The opinions are easier to swallow than facts, the grays instead of the whites and the blacks. If you shoot it too straight, they won't come back, we're selling the news. Virtues with wings, maybe not quite at first, but salaries are paid by the ads, not the birds. We're selling the news. The all men are equal, all is for sale. A powerful dog has been chasing his tail. The lowest common denominator prevails. We're selling the news. I wanna believe you. Is a new religion.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. In this segment of the program, we are going to continue our conversation fighting fake news, media propaganda, and we're going to get more specific on some of these cases. We are very pleased to welcome back to the program journalist Abby Martin, host of the Empire Files on Telesur and also with Media Roots. And we're going to hear more also about her recent dispatches from her trip to Venezuela. Abby Martin, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks so much, Mickey and Peter. Great to be on.
So we were speaking with Rob Williams earlier in the program about the phenomenon of fake news and propaganda and the importance of critical media literacy education to deconstruct that, to understand more clearly and have people be able to consume news in a way that involves critical analysis. And as a journalist, for us at Project Censored, we think you epitomize what's best about journalistic principles because you do seek truth and you do go and shine light in dark places to tell the stories that others won't tell. And at the same time, you can't help but cast shadows on you call out fake news reports. And this doesn't mean you're using the term in the way that people like Donald Trump will use it as a weaponized term to shout down critics. But just because of the integrity of your work, you obviously make it problematic for corporate media narratives. And your most recent work in Venezuela is a classic example of how that's going on. So, Abby Martin, tell us about your latest work and what you've been learning and how that goes against the corporate narrative and State Department narrative we hear in the U.S. about Venezuela.
It's incredible, you guys. I mean, as a media analyst and critic for the last 10 years, you think that you've seen it all, right? You think that you know how to dissect propaganda when you kind of see it coming at your face, when it's coming just churning out ad nauseum, right, from all of these corporate media outlets, and not even corporate media outlets, a lot of leftist media outlets are echoing this same kind of regime change propaganda in regards to Venezuela. But wow, you really almost have to go on the ground to see just how egregious the lies and propaganda is. And I think it's probably the same with Syria. You know, you're embedded with these rebel fighters, and so you kind of apologize for Al-Qaeda, or you end up doing that. But when it comes to Venezuela, it seems like a lot of these outlets just echo the opposition's line and don't go on the ground and actually see for themselves what's going on and how nuanced the situation really is. So I'll talk about what we see. Of course, in the Western media, we see this repressive dictatorship, right, where Venezuela's becoming a totalitarian state, where Maduro's holding on to power. He's mowing down peaceful protesters in the street with these state forces. So, of course, the supermarkets are empty, you know, widespread starvation. People are breaking into zoos to eat the animals. So, of course, we go there expecting just complete and total chaos on the ground with all of these things to be true. And what we saw was actually the complete opposite. There is no widespread famine. Yes, people are eating less and worse now than in recent years because of an overarching economic war. A lot of people think that this is a socialist failure, right? Well, the economy is actually a trifold community, private, and state. So you look at where the shortage is coming from. How is this economic war being played out? Yes, you can't get toilet paper at some of these stores, but then you can get paper towels and napkins and Kleenex. So why is that? You start to realize that things aren't as they seem, that some of these companies have actually exacerbated the crisis by preventing loans. And a lot of these companies are working hand in hand with the opposition. So the economic war going on is very real. It's very strong. It's causing staple goods to be completely gone from the shelves, put in the black market. The companies claim that it's because the government is setting price controls that they can't sell these goods. So that's really the crux of the economic crisis. We talk to people in the street. We say, are you starving? You know, we see in the Western media that you guys are starving and begging on the streets and digging through trash, and they just say, no, that's completely untrue. There's an economic war going on in the media's line. When it comes to the protests, it's very curious as well, because the media completely obfuscates the class nature of these protests. It is completely black and white. The protests on the street are the upper middle class, wealthy people who can afford more food, right? But they use the poor cynically to say that we're starving, we need intervention. These people are the upper middle class people who kind of lost their power, their stronghold on the economy once Chavez got into power. As we know, Chavez and then Maduro, his successor, has won democratically. Jimmy Carter called them the most democratic elections in the world, about 17 elections straight. And so it wasn't until the opposition took power of one of the branches of government in 2015 that we started to see the economic crisis really exacerbate. And when you see this death toll being tossed around about the protests, there's, you know, 140 dead in the streets of Caracas, you realize that there are huge peaceful protests going on all the time from pro-government people, from pro-opposition people, but you see this death toll, and it's actually happening on the front lines of these things called the guarimbas. It's a sustained, violent blockade. We followed one around all night. They commandeered trucks. They lit burning barricades on the freeway. I mean, they're directly provoking these state forces, and of course altercations are going to happen when you're doing this day after day, throwing Molotov cocktails, planting explosives. The character of this protest movement is fascist and violent. They have burned people alive who are allegedly Chavista and black. This has happened plenty of times. Two people have already died from their burns, but they threatened to lynch me. They've threatened Global Vision journalists. They've doused them with gasoline. This is no joke. I can't think of another fascistoid characteristic of a political movement other than maybe the KKK or the neo-Nazis in Ukraine that use the tactic of burning alive political opponents. So it's a very serious situation, and unfortunately, everyone from Vice to CNN glorifies the hell out of these protesters and doesn't talk about what will happen. What will happen if the U.S. overthrows a democratically elected sovereign government and this opposition gets in power? What will happen? Will we see a Pinochet-style dictatorship, a mass privatization of all the Chavista programs? It's very scary that no one talks about the bigger picture here, guys.
Abby, thank you. It's clear that the corporate media continually labels the government as a dictatorship, which is absolute lie. It's completely false. There's been great elections there all along, and they just had an election for a constitutional assembly, which the right claims that they boycotted the election, but some 8 million people voted in this assembly, and they're trying to rewrite their constitution to make sure that the extreme right doesn't take power and ultimately control what's happening there. At the same time, the price of oil, of course, dropped, and that was manipulated by the Saudis and the U.S. globally. Venezuela was undermined in terms of their income from oil substantially. But they still have oil, they're still selling that, and they're continuing in that capacity. So these are important understandings. Now, the supermarket story, the New York Times had a picture of an empty supermarket with a woman shopping there, and it was like a given. This is the supermarkets in Caracas. And you're saying that's false. I know that that's false. So it's really an amazing lie. But it's a lie orchestrated through the corporate media globally from the State Department and surely public relation firms and propaganda firms that work for the State Department and are putting out these lies. They're packaged them.
Yeah, so, and you know, we're talking about a movement that has tried to gain power through undemocratic means ever since Chavez took power. I mean, there was a U.S.-backed coup in 2002 where Chavez was kidnapped for 3 days. I mean, the opposition completely destroyed the Constitution when they got in power. They didn't bother with the nicety of trying to provide some feigned democratic leadership. They eviscerated it. And in 2014, we saw the same thing. I mean, they staged coup after coup, violent uprising after violent uprising, where they're actually encouraging people to burn down buildings. Again, the protesters, as much as they use the starvation and famine as this tool to gain international sympathy, they are burning down food distribution warehouses. They just burned down a warehouse full of 50 tons of food, attacking maternity clinics, seizing hospitals and schools. So there is something very, very disturbing about the character of the protesters. And Peter, you mentioned the Constituent Assembly, and I think that's a really great point, because here you have the opposition boycotting it, right? A couple weeks prior, they had their own kind of fake referendum, which, of course, there were no ballots counted. You can count, you voted multiple times, as a Telesaur undercover investigation showed. The media took that count at face value. 7 million people voted to boycott the Constituent Assembly. Yet they all boycotted the actual election several weeks later. And when you look at that outcome, 8 million people showed up. 8 million people. That is astounding. In a country of 30 million people, for 8 million people to come vote to support that process, right, to support this movement, this Chavista movement that is alive and well and cannot be ruled without this vision incorporated. And that's what the opposition wants to do. It's a fascist vision where they want to rule without Chavismo, without taking the poor in account, with a mass privatization. And that's exactly what the Constituent Assembly was doing. It was supposed to protect the missions, these dozens of missions that have been employed, free healthcare, free education, free housing. They want to protect these things because they are very worried, again, what will happen if the opposition takes power, because it could be very, very ugly, and they know that they need to mobilize to show their strength. And unfortunately, you have the media here just calling it a fraud, you know, calling it a lie. It's absolutely absurd. Every election that they have, you can audit the vote. They have paper ballots. It's way more transparent than the U.S.
Yeah, indeed it is. But you're also describing a similar problem with the U.S. regarding the press and the control of information and propaganda that is seemingly quite pervasive there.
Oh, my God. That's another thing we hear, right? Maduro controls all the press. Maduro jails all political opponents, shuts down all these media outlets that are critical of him. Look, yes, a media outlet, their license wasn't renewed because they were calling to kill the president during one
right.
of the coup attempts 10 years prior. Okay, let's look at the newspapers. I went around Caracas and bought up 10 different newspapers. What was the breakdown? Actually, it was way more diverse than the United States. As we know, the corporate media essentially just echoes state propaganda. It might as well be state media. In Caracas, 8 out of the 10 papers were extremely critical of Maduro. One even said Trump must take care of Maduro. Another one showed Vladimir Padrino, the defense minister, saying the blood is on your hands of all the protesters. Can you imagine? Even police officers that kill black people with total impunity here, can you imagine blaming Trump for that and saying the blood is on your hands, Trump, for all the black unarmed men who were killed by police? So the narrative is very different, and it's the same actually on TV when you break down the Nielsen rating and the amount that is captured in terms of the audience of state versus private media. You're looking at only about 9% audience tuning into state media on TV. So it is a gross exaggeration. And really, we hear that time and again. You know, the countries that they claim, that the Western media claims has no free press, usually has hugely free press.
Certainly relative to the United States that operates under the illusion of a free press. And, of course, Mark Crispin Miller called that out with aerial quotes in the foreword to our last book, Our Free Press. Well, Abby Martin, tell us a little bit more about what you're doing with the program Empire Files and a little bit more about what you have in store for people and where they get more information.
So we did a huge series on Palestine. We did this series on Venezuela, really the hot spots where I feel like the media is completely failing and working on behalf of the U.S. empire. And I'm talking about leftist alternative media as well, really failing on this issue on Venezuela. So we really wanted to provide that nuance, the complexities to that, and really break through the disinformation. And that's what this show really is. Not only is it breaking through the propaganda and disinformation about these issues, you know, the catastrophic wars on multiple fronts that the U.S. empire is facing and Trump is exacerbating, turbocharging the empire, but it's also providing that voice, right, to the marginalized and oppressed people who haven't been able to write history themselves. History has been written by the winners, and we're retelling these lost chapters of American history and things that have happened today to put in the perspective of empire and how it's shaped the world and really bring out these voices of resistance that have been completely censored throughout the years. So it's a beautiful project. We're completely independent. It's really amazing to just have complete editorial freedom and produce whatever we want. We're actually going to Houston 1 month later when all the media vultures and parasites are gone out of people's faces and really analyzing what happened and what needs to be done a month later after the dust settles. So we're looking forward to that coverage, and everyone can check it out on theempirefiles.tv.
What's the website again, Abby?
Theempirefiles.tv.
Okay.
And mediaroots.org.
So, Abby, in the United States, we've seen a strange brew here this past year with the labeling of fake news and how the term has been weaponized by Trump. But it's strange because it really works as a distraction away from the problem we have in the corporate state media here and corporate slash state, a State Department press release or PR industry that controls news here. There really is a fake news problem here, and it's not just satire, and it's not just a weaponized term. It's the fact that we do lack diversity in our media, and we do have hegemonic narratives in the corporate media here, and even in alternative media outlets, including the left media, we lack significant diversity and openness of discussion. But it's that weaponization of the term. And if you go back in history, like the Lügenpresse, right, back in Germany, World War I, World War II, where it's the lying press was a weaponized phrase. So, you know, this is not new. And if we want to really look at real fake news, perhaps we should be looking at CIA involvement in media and deep state involvement. I know that term's been run through the ringer this past year, but going back and looking at media control, given your experience and certainly the narratives that you write about, what are your views on this conundrum that we find ourselves?
Well, it's quite a conundrum, Mickey, because as you just mentioned, the president has weaponized the term to now just have his base of neo-fascists trust only the news that worships him, right? And this kind of crazy propagandistic Breitbart-style Drudge Report aggregation that just exacerbates racial tensions and horrible, horrible sentiment against minorities. So that's one thing, extremely dangerous, right? And I see people every day sharing literal fake news stories from your newswire.com, et cetera, just making stuff up about Trump. They all live in a tiny echo chamber, but your point is very well made about the larger problem of fake news. I mean, how do we get into every war that we've gotten into? New York Times, the purveyor of fake news. Washington Post, the purveyor of fake news. I mean, these are supposed papers of the Beltway, right? The paper of record setting the news of the state. And unfortunately, they lie time and again, exaggerate time and again. Look at Judith Miller. How does she still have a job? This woman should be shamed. She should be in jail. She has the blood of a million Iraqis on her hand. The fact that these people are paraded on the media, David Frum, Eric Prince, given an op-ed in the New York Times talking about how we need to privatize the war in Afghanistan. It's already privatized. So, yes, it's amazing and astounding when you see publications like the New York Times and the Washington Post trying to say what is and what is not fake news. And then when you look at the nitty-gritty, what they're trying to call fake news is essentially all non-corporate funded media. So really, it all goes down in the attack on leftist grassroots alternative media, the organizations that are doing the real work, right? Project Censored, Truth Dig, Counterpunch. And it is a very concerted effort. There's even a new think tank, the PNAC 3.0, coming up that really is only focusing on fake news. You see the attack on RT. It wasn't necessarily about hacking the election. It was about putting out contradictory news that they don't want to put out there.
And you also were to blame somehow, even though you hadn't had a show there for years.
Yeah, I mean, I was in the DNI report because it shows you exactly what they're most scared of. They're most scared of real reporting and real truth-telling. And that's what this new think tank is about. It's about discrediting organizations like RT and organizations that get out information that they do not want people to know. And when half the country is living in poverty, I think it's damn right they're right to know.
And indeed, you know, Trump ran a campaign as a war on the press, shouting, lock them up as journalists. And then he weaponized fake news, taking it out of the mouths of the DNC, per se. And then also that kind of hostility to the press went all the way up to the House race in Montana with Greg Gianforte beating up a Guardian reporter, Ben Jacobs, literally because he didn't want to answer his questions and, in fact, pleaded guilty to even doing this. Of course, he was seated as representative in Montana anyway, because this apparently is the United States where we don't have a free press. But at any rate, you know, just on a concluding point, it's clear that Trump and his supporters don't care about journalism or a free press, you know, or for that matter, an informed populace in a Democratic Republic. And all these histrionics, they're hard to keep up with all the tweeting and things. These really illustrate that it's long past time to insist that we have a robust and critical free press. We exercise it, one that actually fights back, not with snide antics and playground politics where CNN kind of gets into a fistfight and gets into the wrestling ring with Trump, but with actual real investigative reporting that holds the administration accountable for policies and actions, not personality politics, not reality TV, right? And that's, of course, what we see here in the United States, and that's why the corporate press is failing. Ever more time for independent, viable press like yours, Abby Martin, and the Empire Files. So we can't thank you enough for the great work that you do.
Thank you so much, you guys. You guys rock.
Thank you so much, Abby. We will definitely be catching up with you in the near future. Coming up after this musical break, we'll speak with the Associate Director of Project Censor, Dr. Andy Lee Roth, about the newest book we put together from Project Censored called Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World. Stay with us.
Well, it seems like the whole damn world's gone wrong. St. Joe McCarthy is dead and gone. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Don't try to change my mind with facts. To hell with the graduated income tax. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Daily News. Pick up a copy anytime you choose. Seven little pennies in the newsboy's hand, and you ride right along to Never Never Land. You know, John Paul Getty is just plain folks. The UN Charter is a cruel hoax. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. J. Edgar Hoover is the man of the hour. All that he needs is just a little more power. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Daily News. Blues. Pick up a copy anytime you choose. Seven little pennies in the newsboy's hand, and you ride right along to Never Never Land.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. Today's show, we've been focusing on all things media. We've been talking about the propaganda model in a digital age. Of course, we heard from Rob Williams. We've also heard from Abby Martin and discussed her program, The Empire Files, and the importance of a free press in our times. We're now joined by Associate Director of Project Censored, my partner in crime in the Censored Annual Books published by Seven Stories Press. We're joined by Dr. Andy Lee Roth. Andy is co-editor with me of Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World. Andy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's so great to be on the air with you, Mickey.
Indeed. And Andy, of course, you've co-hosted with us and you've been on the show a number of times. And here we are again, another year. And yes, it is another book from Project Censored. And why don't you tell listeners briefly a little bit about this year's book that's coming out on October 3rd?
Well, as you've mentioned, Mickey, the subtitle of the book is Press Freedoms in a, quote, post-truth, end quote, world. And so one of the major themes of the book that runs across all the way from Deepa Kumar's foreword through our introduction and through a number of the substantive chapters is this idea of what does it mean to say we live in a post-truth world? The Oxford dictionaries defined post-truth as describing circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. So what does it mean to talk about the role of journalism and the importance of press freedoms in a world that for many people is defined by this condition of being, quote, post-truth? And part of the argument that I think runs as a thread throughout the book, and the reason we put post-truth in quotations, is that we at Project Censored are not ready to accept that condition as a given, as the new normal, and so forth, that we're pushing back against that idea, as are the many contributors to this year's volume.
Indeed, Andy, that is true. And you mentioned Deepa Kumar, who's at Rutgers, a scholar, author. We've worked with Deepa Kumar before, and this year she graced our book with a fabulous foreword that really begins the Censored 2018 book talking about the Oxford Dictionary post-truth phenomenon and conundrum, and also riffs on another favorite theme of ours, that of the importance of academic freedom and the importance for all subjects to be addressed, to be taught without impunity. And certainly this year's book, Censored 2018, addresses those in the top 25 through the news abuse chapters. Also this year, you and I have an addition that was not in any of the previous books. We have a graphic chapter. Do you want to talk to listeners a little bit about that or some of the other contents here?
The graphic chapter that we have, we've been working for several years to have a chapter in that format as part of the annual yearbook, and we succeeded this year. A fantastic piece with the text by Adam Bessie out at Diablo Valley College and illustrations by Peter Glanting. And of course, we're on the radio now, so we can't show you imagery, but it's possible to talk about some of the influences and some of the name checks in this Trump universe chapter They draw on the visual vocabulary of Jack Kirby's Galacticus and Doctor Doom. They're invoking Ursula Le Guin and name-checking Rod Serling's Twilight Zone and George Orwell's 1984. But all of this, without stealing the thunder of this really moving chapter, is, although it may seem like the Trump universe is a Twilight Zone science fiction type of universe, their argument is that the story is one that can undergo a massive rewrite. And their whole graphic chapter is in some ways a call for us to engage in that significant revision of the storyline.
Indeed, it is. And again, we invite listeners to go to our website, projectcensored.org. Not only are all of our archives there from the radio for nearly 7 years, but our top stories dating back to our founding year in 1976. Our guest is Andy Lee Roth, the Associate Director of Project Censored, and also the co-editor here of Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a, quote, post-truth, end quote, world. Andy Roth, since we were just riffing on images, tell us a little bit about the cover of this year's book. In the intro, we write about Umberto Eco: a democratic civilization will save itself only if it makes the language of the image into a stimulus for critical reflection, not an invitation for hypnosis.
Right. So, yeah, and when Umberto Eco wrote that back in 1979, he was thinking of television screens. But of course, now we carry small-scale screens with us all the time, and we interface with images nearly 24/7 through our various tablets and handheld devices, which brings to relevance the image that is the cover of our book this year. We're so lucky to have worked again with Hillary Allison, who did the cover for the Censored 2016 book. And this year she's given us an image that I think is so powerful and contemporary. The scene is a living room. On the screen of the big screen TV in the living room is a raging fire. On the mantelpiece above the screen showing the fire, there are no fewer than 3 fire extinguishers. And so the imagery I have is of a household that has followed the agenda set by the media as broadcast across their TV. Fire is danger. Fire is a danger. But the image, as Hillary Allison has created it, is one of the living room is actually being flooded. So the danger coming to us over the screen is of one element, fire, and the preparation has been made appropriately for that particular threat. But the real actual danger is another element, water, in the form of flooding. So we talked in our introduction about the richness of this image, and just to pick up one dimension of that, of course it was Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451 that featured this idea of the public being distracted from impending war by the wall-sized screens that bombarded them with nonsense. And in this case, I think Hillary Allison's imagery resonates with that notion from Bradbury's classic. But the danger of fire in the circumstances of global warming is a real one. It's not that the screen is broadcasting nonsense. It's that the screen is setting an agenda or misdirecting the public's attention from what's really going on. And of course, that's a theme that resonates with this idea of, well, do we live in a post-truth world? If it is a post-truth world, how should we best respond, and so forth.
Indeed, and we do respond with the top 25 stories, and certainly in the introduction where we riff around a great quote from the Indian writer Rabindranath Tagore that is, truth comes as a conqueror only because we have lost the art of receiving it as guest, to riff on the post-truth theme. So, Andy Roth, we have about 2 minutes left here in the segment. Could you give our listeners a couple teasers maybe about some of the other things that are in Censored 2018?
Well, you know, one of the things, I don't want to give away too much about this year's top 25 list, except maybe to just tease this one out a little bit. In a period of time going back to the 2016 elections, where we've been inundated by politicians, pundits, and the like about fake news this and fake news that, one of the top stories that we've been tracking this past year and that will feature in this year's top 25 list, a story originally reported by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism out of the UK, out of London, is that the Pentagon paid a UK PR firm millions of dollars over a period of years to produce and distribute fake Al-Qaeda videos. So without going into the details of that story, which will be featuring much more prominently in the upcoming weeks as the book is released, in a year when pundits and politicians of all stripes across the political spectrum as well as members of the public and the establishment press, were crowing over fake news. This is one of the stories that went completely underreported, unacknowledged in the U.S. corporate media. And it's only because of independent investigative journalistic outlets like the Bureau of Investigative Journalism that we know about how one of the most powerful U.S. government institutions, the Department of Defense, secretly used taxpayer money to create fake news of its own.
Indeed, and that is a very powerful story and statement, and there are many, many other similar themes and stories in Censored 2018 out by Seven Stories Press October 3rd, so get your copy when you can. And the rest of the book, of course, we have Media Democracy in Action with our friends at the Index on Censorship and Tribeworthy and others, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We have our colleagues Nolan Higdon, Nicholas Baham III on the New American Authoritarianism and Normalized Racism. Elizabeth Blakey has a fabulous chapter on defamation as censorship in the social media era. We also have some really heavy hitters. Edward Herman from the Propaganda Model fame, Still Manufacturing Consent, the Propaganda Model Authority, and Ralph Nader talks about breaking through power and the mass media blackout of his Super Bowl of Citizen Action. So it's a chock-full book, Censored 2018. Andy Lee Roth, Associate Director of Project Censored, co-editor with me of Censored 2018. Andy, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored show today.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you, Mickey.
That was a conversation with the Associate Director of Project Censored, Dr. Andy Lee Roth. I'm Mickey Huff, and the book that Andy and I were just talking about is our latest from Seven Stories Press. It's Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World. These are the top censored stories and media analysis for the years 2016 and 17. Noam Chomsky has said of Project Censored's work, it's a crucial contribution to the hope for a more just and democratic society. Did you know that over 1,000 communities in the United States are experiencing lead contamination at quadruple the rates found in Flint, Michigan? Or that the U.S. Army has accumulated $6.5 trillion in expenditures that cannot be accounted for? What about the racially biased software used by judges to predict future crimes? Or the fossil fuel industry's influence over environmental research? Haven't heard the news? Well, neither did the rest of the world, and that's because these and countless other news items are suppressed or ignored by our nation's so-called free press every day. For the past 42 years, Project Censored has been unearthing the buried stories that corporate media deem unfit to print and debunking the fake news governments and corporations use to consolidate their power to promote well-informed citizen action and critical media literacy. This year's book, Censored 2018, features The New American Authoritarianism by Nolan Higdon and Nicholas Baham III, whom you recognize from being associate co-hosts of the Project Censored show and podcast. We also have a fantastic graphic chapter this year by Diablo Valley College English professor Adam Bessie, a colleague of mine, and artist Peter Glanting. It's called The Trump Universe, and it is a fantastic look at this dystopic imagery and language that we see being used around the Trump presidency. We also this year have a fantastic chapter by Elizabeth Blakey, Defamation as Censorship in the Social Media Era. This is a great chapter that talks about who has standing, who has First Amendment standing, who counts as a media defendant. We also are delighted to have Edward Herman from Herman and Chomsky's Manufacturing Consent fame. Edward Herman did a chapter for us called Still Manufacturing Consent, the Propaganda Model at 30. And Ralph Nader rounds out Censored 2018 with Breaking Through Power. He talks about how his events in Washington, D.C. were the subject of a media blackout, even though it was a Super Bowl of citizen action. All of that and more in Censored 2018, the top censored stories of the past year, junk food news, news abuse, and media democracy in action. And again, that is a great way for us to kind of finalize today's show, which was based on media literacy, critical media literacy, and the fights against censorship. Again, I'm Mickey Huff, and this is the Project Censored Show. I'm just going to tell you a few other things that you can find in the pages of Censored 2018. Again, there's a lot of contents in Censored 2018 that you'll likely hear over the course of the next several months, as we'll be interviewing the people, the intrepid journalists, the independent press, who have covered the important stories that we need to know about. And not only are they in the book and online and published originally, of course, at the outlets where they write and work, we, of course, link all of the original articles and urge you to support these kind of independent outlets. Again, Censored 2018, Andy Lee Roth, myself, Mickey Huff with Project Censored are the editors. We have a fantastic foreword by Deepa Kumar, the scholar from Rutgers University who writes on Islamophobia. Khalil Bendib, once again, has fantastic cartoons that add to the book. And just, again, a couple more teasers for you to go out and pick up a copy of this. We have stories on big data and dark money behind the 2016 election that have a lot more to do with the outcome than so-called fake news. We have another story on voter suppression. Again, far more likely that this has to do with the outcome of the election along with the Electoral College than fake news. A blockbuster story on Pentagon-paid United Kingdom public relations firms making fake Al-Qaeda videos. The Pentagon paid a UK PR firm to make fake Al-Qaeda videos talking about fake news. We also have record year of global internet shutdowns. We also have Shell Oil understanding that climate change was a problem with their industry as early as 1991, and they chose to ignore it. And we also have some good news stories about how young plaintiffs invoke constitutional grounds for climate protection. So these, again, are fantastic stories in the book, 8 Use of Force Policies to Prevent Killings by Police. So again, there's a lot going on in the book, including Media Democracy for Action with our friends at Triberthy. Also some pieces by Kevin Gastolia and Rana Kalik at Unauthorized Disclosure, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Rachel Jolly and the Index on Censorship. Again, Censored 2018, out now, 7 Stories Press. To learn more, go to projectcensored.org.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. The Project Censored Show airs on 40 stations around the U.S., from Maui to New York. Peter and I are executive producers and co-hosts. Anthony Fest, our producer. Erica Bridgman, our engineer. To learn more about the Project Censored Show and our parent nonprofit Media Freedom Foundation, go to projectcensored.org. To hear our past programs and special Project Censored podcast with our associate hosts Nolan Higdon, Nick Bayham, and Desiree McSwain, go to projectcensored.org/radio. Click on our podcast on our Patreon page. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We'll see you next time.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show,
Roy Cohn was this vicious, vicious lawyer. He was the attack dog for Joe McCarthy. And then he went to New York. He was, by his own account, under indictment 2/3 of his life. He always made his clients pay him in cash. So he claimed to the IRS he had no money, but he had a private plane and he had a mansion in Connecticut and another place somewhere down in the warm area of Florida or somewhere. And he had mobsters as clients, and he was a fixer. And he had Donald Trump as a client. And one of the things he taught Donald Trump was, if the government finds you've done something wrong, you just turn around and accuse them of wrongdoing.
Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist David K. Johnston joins us for the hour. David K. Johnston has been covering the business transactions of Donald Trump for almost 30 years now. He is the author of the book, It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. He joins us next on Letters in Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. On Capitol Hill, lawmakers pressed to enact a massive budget deal along with a temporary funding measure to prevent a government shutdown at midnight. Republican leaders moved to shore up support among conservatives for the bipartisan Senate plan to shower the Pentagon and domestic programs with an extra $300 billion over the next 2 years. Senate Democratic Minority Leader Chuck Schumer urged support for the measure.
Let this budget go forward through both chambers and onto the president's desk, where President Trump seems willing and ready to sign. President Trump was not involved in this process. He was not constructive when he spoke and tweeted. He asked for a shutdown. I think in this body, and I hope my colleagues on the other side of the aisle are learning this, that oftentimes we can get a lot more done working with one another and let the White House just sit on the sidelines.
While the budget measure is expected to sail through the Senate, not so in the House. Republican Speaker Paul Ryan said it would need bipartisan support there. That's because many deficit hawks among the far-right Freedom Caucus say they won't support it. Democrats led by House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi say they won't vote for a budget deal absent a guarantee by Speaker Ryan to bring legislation to the floor protecting the young undocumented immigrants known as Dreamers. Yesterday, Pelosi spoke for a record 8 hours on the House floor. Today, she repeated her demand that Ryan allow debate and votes on the various immigration bills proposed by Democrats and Republicans.
It's the easiest thing that he could do. Bring everything to the floor. You want to bring Goodlatte to the floor? Bring Goodlatte to the floor. We want the Heard Aguilar bill brought to the floor? Bring that to the floor. The Senate has a proposal. Give the House a vote on that. Anybody else who has some, let everybody vote what they believe. I have the Queen of the Hill. Queen of the Hill means the bill that gets the most votes is the one that prevails.
Ryan has said he won't bring immigration legislation to the floor unless Donald Trump supports it. One of Donald Trump's top White House aides has resigned following allegations of domestic abuse leveled against him by his two ex-wives. Rob Porter's former wives recounted physical, verbal, and emotional abuse. Staff Secretary Porter said in a written statement that the allegations that became public this week are outrageous and simply false. Porter was a top aide to White House Chief of Staff John Kelly. CBS News reported that the allegations had prevented Porter from obtaining a full security clearance and that many people in the White House were aware of the charges before they were reported by the media. CNN says Kelly was aware of them for months. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un presided over a military parade in Pyongyang's Kim Il-sung Square. The parade marked the 70th anniversary of the founding of its military. It took place on the eve of the Winter Olympics in South Korea. Instead of broadcasting the event live, North Korean TV aired an edited version later in the day, giving it a somewhat lower profile. South Korean President Moon Jae-in plans to meet North Korean leader Kim Il-sung's sister and other senior North Korean officials who are coming to the South on Friday for the Olympics. Kim Yo-jong will be the first member of North Korea's ruling family to visit the South since the Korean War in the 1950s. Vice President Mike Pence is also in South Korea, where he's pushing the president to adopt a more hawkish stance towards the North. In a speech to a U.S. airbase in Japan before arriving in South Korea, Pence again warned all options are on the table when it comes to North Korea.
We are ready for any eventuality. The United States of America will always seek peace. We will ever strive for a better future. But you, the instruments of American power, know. And let our adversaries know. All options are on the table.
As he welcomed Pence, the South Korean president took the opportunity to highlight the visit of North Korean officials to the Games. Moon called them Olympic Games of Peace and added his hope that the Games become a venue that leads to dialogue for the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. I'm Eileen Alfandari. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich and I'm very happy to welcome back to our radio station Pulitzer Prize winning investigative journalist David K. Johnston. Now, David K. Johnston has written a number of books and he's also, for three decades now has covered Donald Trump. He has a new book out. It's called Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. David K. Johnston, it is a very good pleasure to see you again. Thank you for being here.
Well, hey, Mitch, thank you for having me back again.
And I'm glad you're here because I actually want to get your take as we begin about what in the world is happening in Washington, D.C. And right now there's just all this controversy over memos and, you know, these investigations. What's your read? What's happening?
Well, fundamentally, Donald Trump differs from every other president. 44 came before. In that every one of them, even Andrew Jackson.
That's what I was going to say, even Andrew Jackson.
Even Andrew Jackson, whose painting looks down upon Donald Trump in the Oval Office.
He returned it.
They all believed they were doing something to make America better. Some failed, some succeeded, some had good ideas, some had terrible ideas, some were middling, utterly forgettable. Donald Trump is about one thing. He's about Donald Trump. And anytime he tells you anything, it's about Donald Trump. It is about the glorification of the self-described, genetically superior, world's smartest person, greatest expert on more than 20 subjects, world's greatest memory, except when he can't recall, Donald Trump. And so you have to view everything he does through this lens, that this is not, to put policy and Donald Trump in the same sentence, to put it in the same paragraph, is, to do violence to policy word.
I agree with everything you just said there. I think everyone who watches him will agree with that as well. Can it be argued that his success or lack of success as president then reflects on the legacy and just the brand of Donald Trump?
I sure hope so.
That way he has a vested interest to make things work?
I sure hope it does, because he doesn't have the skill to make things work. And, if you live by the rising stock market, you're going to die by the rising stock market, and eventually stock markets go down. If you live by, look at all the jobs I created, and you're creating fewer jobs than your predecessor did over 7 years, although expectedly so because we're nearing full employment, then you're going to live by that. And the really important thing, Mitch, and the thing I try to do, and it's even worse than you think, is the press corps totally blew the campaign, utterly failed to tell American people who Trump really is, about his criminal associations and his beating grand juries and deep involvement with American and Russian and Georgian and Azerbaijani criminals. They're doing a real good job of covering the palace intrigue and the tweets and the craziness in the White House. I think that coverage has been just splendid. But they're not covering what matters to you. They're not covering the government. And in the book, I assert that Trump's team, not Trump because he's lazy, have loosed political termites into the structure of our government. And they are destroying the capacity of our government to protect you on the job, to see to it that you or your children or grandchildren have your lives shortened by pollutants, a whole variety of other things. And they are basically creating a government. And remember, Donald Trump ran as, I'm the champion of the forgotten man. I alone can save you. He is creating a government of, by, and for, not just the rich. He's creating a government of, by, and for the most predatory among the rich. He said, I'm going to drain the swamp? No. He went out and stocked it with swamp monsters.
I want to get into that. And I want to get into these things that are actually happening within the administration, within government, that perhaps we're not hearing as much about that. Before we do, let me ask you this then. Do you think the coverage and the interest and even this Robert Mueller investigation that's going on into the 2016 election, what we're seeing happening with dueling memos on Capitol Hill, do you think that is legitimate? Do you think we're missing the ball by paying so much attention to that?
No, I mean, I think a lot of attention should be paid to it, because what Donald is trying to do is compromise and ultimately, if he can, shut down
Robert Mueller's investigation. Donald knows what he did. He knows that Robert Mueller is going to come up with an absolutely solid case of traitorous conduct, of criminal violations of the law, and he needs to shut that down if he's going to continue. And Mueller's going to turn up stuff that if they believe it, even many diehard Trump supporters, perhaps not the racists, but the other diehard supporters, are going to be shocked by. So that's why Trump has to keep denigrating the FBI so that when the report comes out, he can argue, you know, this is fake investigative report. And
he's not the only one. What do you think about Republican lawmakers as well, you know, painting this narrative that the FBI is corrupt? And you know, this is, we've here have had concern over the years for about the FBI, not over this, obviously, but right. But that the FBI is corrupt and is purposefully trying to discredit his presidency.
Right. Well, first of all, it's kind of a bizarre charge because Robert Mueller's a Republican. Yeah. I mean, just as starters. But look, the FBI has done lots of very troublesome things over the years, from setting people up for crimes to planting fake evidence and other things. But overall, the FBI as an institution has been a great strength of the United States. And we are correct to pay a lot of attention and raise hell about the things that are wrong, because we want to eliminate those and keep the things they do right. But Trump here is basically trying to just denigrate and destroy it. And the Association of Former FBI Agents has now several times basically denounced Trump. They've been a little more polite than that, but made it clear that they're outraged about this. One of the most important principles of law is you don't get to pick your prosecutor. And there's a lot of people in prison, some of them innocent, who are there because they didn't get to pick their prosecutor. Donald Trump is trying to pick his prosecutor. He wants someone loyal to him. That is, he wants a system in which he can be assured that whatever wrong he does, his prosecutor will find a way to make it go away. And we have to say, no, we're not going to do that. And we need to remember, and you'll hear me say this a lot, it's our government. It's not the government. It's our government. And Donald Trump, despite Omarosa's statement that everyone will bend their knee, is our employee. He is accountable to us. And the question I think we face in America right now is we've made a terrible mistake. I think a majority of Americans clearly recognize we've made a terrible mistake. Are we going to correct it? And the way to correct that is, under our Constitution, like it or not, we don't have, you know, votes of confidence like parliamentary systems. The way we correct that is, come November, people have to turn out to vote. They have to register. They have to get other people to the polls. They have to actually cast ballots. And Democrats have to run competent candidates, which I'm very concerned about. And those Republicans who are going to stay in office have to be Republicans who will do their constitutional duty. Otherwise, hey, don't complain.
Yeah,
you get the government. You didn't want to participate. You want to be one of the 91 million people who didn't vote. Then fine. If we become a fascist country, when they come to shoot you, you know, don't complain.
I suspect that there will be big victories for Democrats this November
maybe,
in the midterm
election.
Maybe.
I'm a little less hopeful than you are because, well, among other things, so far, now we'll get new data in a few days,
yeah.
But so far, you would think that the Republican National Committee would be having trouble raising money and the Democrats would be rolling in dough. It's the exact opposite. And there's a second problem. We all know the Democrats are against Trump. What are they for? What is their economic platform? What are they going to do for the 90% of Americans whose incomes have been stagnant since 1967?
You don't think they could pull it off? Being against Trump is enough at this
point?
No,
it's not enough. No, you got to have what I'm for and what we're better for. And they also have to start showing that this new tax bill that was passed, Mitch, is brilliantly conceived.
Yeah.
People who haven't had a raise in years in real terms are suddenly going to have $10, $20, $30, $40 a week more in their pocket.
This month.
And they're going to feel good about that. And the Republicans are going to make a big deal of that. And it's going to have a stimulative effect. Some of them will pay down debt, but a lot of them are going to do things that spend the money. And the bills for that will come due after the election. And one other item in that regard. Everybody listening to this show has heard that Apple is bringing home paying $38 billion in taxes to bring overseas money home, that other companies are doing the same thing. No, they are not. At DC Report, we actually read the bills Congress passes before we write about them. And it turns out that what Apple got, Apple had billions of dollars offshore, untaxed, effectively borrowing from the government at zero interest, the taxes that you and I have to pay before we can get the rest of our paycheck. They got an 8-year extension of their zero interest loans. They're paying 8% of the money this year, and they'll pay the last 25%, so it's backloaded, like a balloon payment on a mortgage, in 2025. And they don't have to bring the money home. What they got was the right to either bring it home or send it offshore as they choose, which is entirely different than the narrative in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the AP, everywhere else, because they all got their story from Apple's flax.
So, again, I still suspect, and I could be wrong, I was definitely wrong about the 2016 election, but I suspect Democrats have a good turnout in November, but it would not surprise me to see, come 2020, Donald Trump actually win re-election, because I think in a strange way we have an addiction to Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think it is a possibility that he will get a second term, and particularly if the economy is doing well and the Democrats don't have an agenda, and if he manages to suppress the Robert Mueller investigation, and instead of turning out in the streets, which is what we should do, if Robert Mueller is fired, the 6 million biggest demonstration in American history, the Women's March, that should be supplanted by the 12 or 15 million people in the streets. Because if Robert Mueller is fired, we don't have the rule of law. We're just getting closer and closer to being a country like Vladimir Putin's Russia. And after all, what is it that Donald Trump keeps admiring? Vladimir Putin's Russia. And in that country, hey, Donald Trump doesn't like me, he'll have me swept off the streets.
So you think there is no way that we find and we see these memos that it suggests the FBI misused the Steele dossier and misused the FISA process to get to legitimately get access to Carter Page.
Maybe we will find something. Adam Schiff says that they've cherry-picked all the data. Yeah. But if we had the full report, you know, you and I might look at something and say, gee, you know, that's pretty sketchy. That looks inappropriate. But overall, is the question you want to ask. I mean, no one expects this radio station or the FBI to be perfect, but we do expect you to behave with integrity, with respect for the law, and to try to do your best. And you take your criticisms for the mistakes you make. And the suggestion that the FBI, led by a Republican in this investigation, the special prosecutor Robert Mueller, and is anti-Trump is just laughable. And we need to push back about that. And we need to recognize that this congressman down in Fresno,
Devin Nunes, his
behavior is just atrocious. Just on the fact that his disregard for what the FBI says, this is extreme partisanship of an unbelievable degree. One of the things we need to get to fix Congress, back before jet airplanes, Democrats and Republicans lived together in houses, and these men would be away for weeks at a time. They would play cards. They would drink. They would do other things, grown men away from home for a long period of time are known to do. And they each
knew about what we need in order to fix this government.
But because of this, they knew each other's sort of behaviors and secrets and, you know, who went to church every day and who had a girlfriend somewhere. Yeah. And they behaved, therefore, and compromised things. And they understood each other as human beings. Somebody said the other day, I thought it was a brilliant observation, that today bipartisanship in Washington is a Democrat and a Republican sharing an Uber.
Well, you know, I mean, I've always sort of taken a Ralph Nader kind of view of Congress, the duopoly, two sides of one coin. But I feel right now that there has been a rupture within this, what I would call the ruling class.
Oh, no, I agree with you with that. I think we're at a real inflection point. I believe this election in the fall is the most important domestic election since the Civil War. And I'm including 1932 in that, because if the American people say no, we are going to be a society of laws, and we may have presidents who aren't very good, and we may have ones who thought they were doing the right thing, like Bill Clinton, and screwed up the economy royally, but we are not going to have a criminal in the White House. then we're going to go back on the path of the purpose of this country. And the purpose of this country is to ennoble the human spirit to see how human beings and human society can develop. Donald Trump wants a society that's like we've always had. You know, he wants one where the king tells you what to do and he doesn't like you, off with your head.
Yeah.
And while he's incompetent at what he's doing, there are people out there right now watching Trump and licking their chops and thinking, well, I know how to organize. I know how to manage. I know how to work 15 hours a day. I know how to shape images. That is, people without Donald Trump's deficits. And if we don't correct this awful mistake that we have made, that's the direction we're going to end up going.
Rarely do things ever snap back to the way they were before.
Yeah.
It's usually one person or one party or one entity does something different and pushes the envelope, and then instead of not doing that again, the other side then does.
Yeah. And so it really matters. I mean, we have to be engaged. It's our government. One of the things we say at DC Report is it's our government. We own it. We need to act like owners. You can't outsource this stuff. When you outsource it, the Koch brothers have a government of, by, and for the Koch brothers. Uh-uh. We want a government that's our government. And if you're saying to yourself listening to this, well, I'm just nobody. I'm just one person. Yeah, that's how it works. You know, every little one person is what makes it work.
One last question about the Mueller investigation, and then we'll get into the more of the contents of your book. And I find this interesting because I keep thinking of this person's name. He's no longer alive, but I learned a lot about this person, actually, through many interviews that I've done with you over the years. And looking at how the Republicans and Donald Trump, the Trump campaign, is responding to this investigation. And the name is Roy Cohn.
Oh, yes.
Roy Cohn. This is Roy Cohn's playbook.
Yeah, and it's Roy Cohn's most successful student. Roy Cohn was this just vicious, vicious lawyer. He was the attack dog for Joe McCarthy.
Yeah.
And then he went to New York. He was, by his own account, under indictment two-thirds of his life. He always made his clients pay him in cash. So he claimed to the IRS he had no money, but he had a private plane and he had a mansion in Connecticut and another place somewhere down in the warm area of Florida or somewhere. And he had mobsters as clients, and he was a fixer. And he had Donald Trump as a client. And one of the things he taught Donald Trump was, if the government finds you've done something wrong, you just turn around and accuse them of wrongdoing. Sort of notice a pattern here?
Yes.
And so when right after Martin Luther King died, in just days, Congress passed the Fair Housing Act. Federal investigators were sent to test for housing discrimination. So they would send out an individual or a couple who were Black or Hispanic or Puerto Rican who were qualified to rent apartments. They had solid financial background. And they would show up at Trump apartment buildings, and they would be told, no, there's no units available here. But if you go over to this other building we have units. And that's where they put people who are Black and Puerto Rican. Then a white couple or individual with the same finances would be sent. They'd say, oh, yes, we have a half a dozen apartments available today. Can we please show them to you? And when the government sued, Roy Cohn and Donald Trump held a press conference at the New York Hilton, and they said, the government is trying to force us to take welfare people into our buildings and destroy the value of our property. Absolute, utter nonsense, but go back and read the news accounts from then, as I've done. Their message got through loud and clear.
Did they sue as well?
So the government took Trump to court, and in a very telling sign, the government assigned the case to a newly minted lawyer, a woman who I don't think had tried a single case. She'd only been with the government a few months. And she very promptly mopped the floor with Roy Cohn. She really dug in and did her work. And so they then agreed to 2 years of court supervision. Mm-hmm. And there was no racial discrimination for 2 years, and then they got it lifted. And then guess what? They went back to marking P and C for Puerto Rican or colored and rejecting people. And this is indicative of how Roy Cohn taught Donald Trump. You go on the attack. You deny, deny, deny. You compromise the police investigation. If you can find a way, the detective who's after you, if you can find out anything you can do, you know, maybe you can lure him into smoking a joint or doing something with a hooker on the street,
lure
or whatever
him into
it is.
It too.
Oh, yeah. You just compromise and destroy that person because now you can destroy the investigation. Donald beat four grand jury investigations in the 1970s and early 80s.
So this is the playbook. And yeah. This is what we're, you imagine what we're seeing right
and
now.
And, of course, Roy was the lawyer for the heads of both the Gambino and Genovese crime families, and Donald Trump's father's business partner, Willie Tomasello, was an associate of the Gambino and Genovese crime families. The Trump ties to not just Italian mobsters, but all sorts of criminals go back pretty much almost a century now.
And Roy Cohn was gay.
Yes, he was a man who absolutely denied he was gay.
Well, he went after homosexuals. I mean, this is a period they went after homosexuals as communists.
Yes, yeah. That's right.
Yeah, and he was gay at the time, or he was gay. Again, we are in conversation with David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author of the new book, It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. Okay, now more on the themes of your book, and I think this is quite timely, and obviously you published this book before this latest news story broke, but that is concerning the former director of the Center for Disease Control. Brenda Fitzgerald has just resigned because it was known that, well, she had purchased stocks in tobacco companies.
And the Surgeon General also was an investor in tobacco companies. And what is probably the most important duty of the Surgeon General? Finding ways to make sure that more young people don't take up smoking. You can't make this stuff up.
But it perfectly illustrates, I think, what you're saying in this book, what's happening in our government, which isn't getting the amount of attention as, say, the Mueller investigation.
Absolutely. And the fundamental problem here is, you know, remember, the fastest disappearing white-collar job in America in this century is journalist. The L.A. Times, where when I worked there, I think there were 1,100 journalists. They eventually had 1,200. Is now down to less than 400. Hmm. The Bay Area News Group, everything but the Chronicle, basically, in the Bay Area is down to, well, the Mercury apparently is down to less than 40 reporters. When I was hired there as a 19-year-old staff writer in 1968, I think the staff was about 240. Somewhere in that range, 200 plus. And the job isn't being done. So there's no coverage of the government. There's no mainstream reporter at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which has enormous influence over how much money comes out of your pocket every month to pay for utilities. There's nobody seriously covering housing and urban development. And they don't have contacts and beat background. So when we do get coverage, it's basically coverage by press release.
Right, right. And we also, the press, it's been called the fourth estate of government. And it might just sound cute, what a nice name, but it's actually more than that.
I mean, it's important enough that the framers of the Constitution put it in the First Amendment. Yeah. And Thomas Jefferson famously said, you know, given a choice between a government without newspapers and newspapers without a government, you know, he'd go with the newspapers. So what I'm trying to do in It's Even Worse Than You Think is show you what's being done to our government, but more importantly, how that affects you. Because, you know, I don't imagine you wake up in the morning, Mitch, saying, gee, how well are they doing running the Education Department or the Interior Department or the EPA? But if something they're doing means that you, or if you have children or grandchildren, are much more likely to get cancer or asthma, by the way, 10 or 15 years from now, so no matter what, Donald Trump shouldn't be in office. That should concern you and is likely to do so. And so that's what I'm trying to do. Show you're not hearing this stuff. And once you hear this, you need to tell other people because you got to get people motivated to understand it matters to you if you're going to get people to vote.
I mean, what a terrible combination here. These things, this really dismantling, I would say, of government from the EPA
that's their
to
stated
everywhere
goal.
Else.
We are going to deconstruct the federal government.
And not having people following it and reporting on it.
Right. And not only – well, even the reporters who try to do it, they're refusing to provide information. For example, under Obama, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration put out press releases when workers were killed for reasons that it was pretty clear were not just real accidents. These were preventable things that a good company would not have had happen. They stopped putting those up. We reported on it at a DC report. Then they put them back up for a while. Now, I can't say that we caused it. That's the timeline. But then they stopped doing it again. Then they stopped posting worker deaths. There has not been a worker death posted at the Labor Department's website since last August. So now the logical question is, okay, you don't want to give us the names of who was killed, who was crushed, who was electrocuted, Well, how about just the raw statistical information? You know, so many people were killed, so many were electrocuted, so many were men, so many were women, so many were crushed. No, they won't give you that either. And that's really a signal to the worst employers, not the employer, the majority of employers are trying to do a decent job, but the ones who say, well, we can save some money here and it's cheaper to let one of our workers die. They're the ones who benefit from this. And this is awful. I mean, this is evil.
Yeah.
And people don't know about it. That's why I did the book. I want people to know this is what's happening that you're not hearing about. And don't be cynical. I get so frustrated. I've done a speech every night this week, starting Sunday, in New York, in Seattle, in Los Angeles, and twice. And then tonight I'll be in San Francisco. And I get people in the audience who go, well, I don't want to hear anything more about Trump. That's exactly what he wants. You're being his friend. You have a duty as a citizen. And I know I get criticism from people. I keep blaming the voters. But that's the system. The system is voters decide. And if you don't learn what the facts are and tell other people with real information and deal with the substance, not the falderal. You know, let's deal with the vegetables, not the icing on the cake.
Well, you are a student and teacher of the classics, the ancient world. Plato was somebody who was not in favor of democracy. He said it would turn into, I think it was an ochlocracy, meaning ruled by a mob.
And the framers of our Constitution made it such a conservative document. You want to completely change the government. You want to place every member of Congress and the president. It takes 6 years. They put in the checks and balances. You know, the first check that failed in our Constitution was the Electoral College. Why do we have the Electoral College? You'll hear people say, well, so the small states will have more of a voice. But if you go read the writings of the framers, they also felt it was terribly important to prevent mob rule. If there was someone who was a zealot, who was a threat to the country, who was incompetent, who was crazy, but had won the popular vote, the Electoral College was to stop them. Well, we never used it all these times for this. It atrophied. There were a couple of electors who refused to vote for Trump, but they were supposed to say, no, you know, you're a liar, you're a criminal, you're unfit, and it didn't work. And now we're seeing the Republicans in Congress not doing their duty as a check and a balance. They're being lapdogs to him. So it's a reasonable concern. You don't want mob rule. That's why we have it.
That's why we have checks and balances.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And we don't have, as in the parliamentary system, a vote of confidence where we then call a new election suddenly.
You will forgive me for going back now to the Justice Department. The
sure.
Justice Department and even this Mueller inquiry. But could it be said that the Justice Department is different than other departments of government? And you even notice we don't have a Secretary of Justice. We have an Attorney General. Because when we think of checks and balances, we think of the Supreme Court, we think of the Congress, we think of the presidency being separate and a check on one another. But my understanding is even the Justice Department is supposed to serve as a check.
The Justice Department in particular, but all law enforcement agencies, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is a law enforcement agency, are supposed to be independent. The IRS is supposed to be independent. It has been, by the way, despite nonsense that you hear to the contrary. And in particular, we don't want the president being able to go say, hey, go after Hillary Clinton and file a case against her. Or here's somebody who was disloyal to me, you know, threaten them with indictment if they don't pay me money. That's why we make the Justice Department separate. And we say, you know, the president, you get to appoint who's your attorney general.
Yeah.
But Donald Trump talks about my Justice Department.
He's asking everyone for their allegiance.
He goes to Comey, and I don't think there's any question that this happened with Comey, despite Trump's denial. He asked for his loyalty. And the reason you know that he did it is there's video of Donald during the campaign asking everyone in the room to raise their hand and pledge their personal loyalty to him. That's not our system. Your loyalty is to the Constitution. Your loyalty is to America. It's one of the reasons I say Donald Trump is a disloyal American. In the dealings with the Russians, we're going to have clear proof before long. He's a traitor.
And it's now being reported that Rod Rosenstein, Deputy Attorney General, who's overseeing the Mueller investigation, he asked Rosenstein for
a personal loyalty pledge.
Yeah.
And Trump can't fire Mueller directly. So we would have to see.
You have to get rid of Rosenstein.
You have to get Rosenstein, and then the next person in line, he'll find somebody somewhere who will do this. In fact, Robert Bork, who on the Saturday Night Massacre fired Archibald Cox, he didn't do that because he was super loyal. It was a deal that was made. Attorney General Richardson said, Mr. President, I'm not going to do that. I resign. Deputy Attorney General Ruckelshaus said, fire me. But they had both agreed that Bork, the next in line, would do it. And the reason was they were fearful that if it got any further down, they might run into somebody who wanted to help Nixon and said, by the way, let's fire all the attorneys working on this. And the attorneys who were working on the Watergate case, Jill Wan Banks, Richard Benvenisti, et cetera, the next morning all showed up at work and made sure the TV cameras knew they were coming to work to send a signal.
And just parallel to that history, Richard Nixon was not impeached or was not going to be impeached. He resigned before it actually happened. It wasn't over him ordering the burglary of Watergate Hotel. It was the cover-up. It was the obstruction of
justice. And one thing to think about this, I'm sure the audience listening to this is not an audience that likes Richard Nixon.
No.
Okay, I certainly don't like Richard Nixon. But nobody thinks for one second that Richard Nixon was an agent of a foreign government. Nobody thought he went to China because he was a stooge for Mao. And Richard Nixon proved that he was a patriotic American for all of his flaws, his criminality, all the bad things he did, because when he realized that not one single senator or congressman supported him anymore because he had done these things, he resigned.
Yeah.
That's what a patriotic American does.
But it looks like the Republicans are backing Trump here.
Yes.
I mean, that's fundamentally different than
and
what we
saw. They're backing him because look what happened to Jeff Flake. Flakes are the first family of Arizona. They're the founders. There's a town named for them, Snowflake. And Jeff Flake cannot run for another term. Now, he's a libertarian, but he's a principled libertarian, at least, and he stood up to Trump, and they've made it clear, if you run, we will run a campaign that won't just cause your defeat, it will personally destroy you. And so he said, that's it, I'm out of here. And Corker, same thing. And unfortunately, John McCain, when push came to shove on the last bill that he would vote on, the tax bill, he went with the Republican, we got to have lower taxes, instead of doing the right thing, which is to say, this is the worst tax bill in American history, and I want tax cuts and lower taxes, but not these.
Yeah.
He didn't do it, to his everlasting shame.
And now we've heard, and I find this interesting, Trey Gowdy, a Republican representative from South Carolina who was chairing the Select Committee on Benghazi, sort of a real bulldog investigator for Republicans. He has now announced that he's stepping down, which is strange to me.
Well,
Daryl Issa, who is the chair of the Government Oversight Committee, also a real bulldog in these investigations.
And the richest man in Congress.
Because of car alarms.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
the Viper.
He was a car thief when he was a teenager. Daryl Issa isn't running because in his district down near San Diego.
It's a tough district.
Now it's a district that's changed.
Yeah.
Trey Gowdy, who Dana Milbank of the Washington Post had a great column a couple of days ago where it was Representative Trey Gowdy, R. Benghazi. as if, you know, we say R. Florida.
Yeah,
Benghazi. Trey Gowdy's departure is, I think, significant because it goes to how many Republicans think they won't win. And this is the big opportunity in the House.
I know that.
But there must be something that he thinks is a problem for him or he wouldn't leave. But he's now created, and I should have started this better, he's now created another open district. It's very hard to change a district. If you're an R district, you tend to stay R. Yeah. If you're a D, you stay D. Once it's an open seat, you can change things. And the principle in gerrymandering, the mathematical principle, is you try to create districts favoring your party with 53, 54, 55%. Well, if you turn out the vote, if you do the work, if you knock on doors and you behave like a citizen who's an owner of the country and cares, you can beat a gerrymandering district and turn it from one to the other. But you got to do the work. You know, putting posts on the, you know, Democratic Underground or Daily Kos, wasting time. You know, get out and do the work.
Yeah. And these elections are very important, this one and also 2020, because after 2020, well, that's when we'll have the census.
That's
Bureau,
right. And the gerrymandering you've seen will get even worse, and there'll be more laws passed to disenfranchise people.
Yeah. That's interesting about Trey Gowdy in an open district, because my thought was, well, perhaps he's looking, and he's been a supporter of Trump in this and critical of the FBI, but I was wondering if he is getting the sense that this is not going to turn out well. Maybe he thinks that this is not going to turn out well for people that are backing Trump.
Well, we'll probably
going
find
after
out
the
eventually.
FBI.
At some point, we're going to find, you know, all secrets come out in time. We may not live long enough to see them, but they all eventually come out.
We are in conversation with David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize winning author, journalist and author. His latest book is called It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. You are also an expert on the tax code.
Yep. My next book after this is I'm proposing an entirely new federal tax system. I would be out by now except for Donald.
Except for Donald Trump. was this reform?
No.
That we just got, or was it just tax cuts?
This is the worst tax bill ever passed by the American Congress. Ordinary people are going to get something, but it's crumbs. On the individual side, more than 80% of the tax savings go to the 1%. Now, half of the 1% are married couples who both work full-time. It's a doctor married to a lawyer, a college professor married to a successful small business owner. And they make $500,000, $600,000 a year. Don't feel sorry for them, okay? But they're not plutocrats. They're going to work every day to make that kind of money. The benefits of this bill go overwhelmingly to the people who make $2 million a year and up and $30 million a year and up. That's the top one in 1,000 and one in 10,000. And the higher you go, the bigger the savings that you get. If you're one of the 141 American executives who was paid on average more than $100 million in 2015, if that's what you make this year, you get a tax savings of at least $2 million on your pay. And, you know, if you're making $100 million plus a year in salary, I really don't think you're in financial distress.
Yeah.
You know, there's no need for your tax relief. And if the idea is that if you don't get 2 cents off your tax bill for every dollar you make, you won't work as hard. Hey, guess what? Maybe you should retire and we'll find somebody more ambitious, because there are plenty of people who for that kind of salary will work hard and be successful at it. It's the business side that's the most troubling. First of all, they're micromanaging. The Republicans are always complaining about micromanaging the economy. But the reduced tax rate for businesses, Trump gets to reduce his from essentially 40% down to 20, plus not counting 20% of his income, which really means he's paying 15 or 16%. But doctors and lawyers and accountants who make over a certain amount of money, I think it's around $315,000 for a married couple, they don't get those benefits. Of course, we know that if there's any group of people that the Republicans are always attacking, it's the lawyers. Why? Yeah. Because lawyers do lots of things you and I don't like, but they're also the people who defend our liberties.
Yeah.
You know, as I taught my law students, and I'm not a lawyer, but as I taught my third-year law students, lawyers are the grease that makes democracy work. Just never forget that you're the grease.
That's right. Do you think that there is also this, and again, the topic of your book is sort of the destruction of government from within, EPA, you have Scott Pruitt, we know about that. We can talk about that too. But are you seeing that that same type of dynamic within the IRS?
Well, what they're doing, the IRS is starving it.
Yeah.
The IRS doesn't have any resources to go after things. So if you are a wage earner, you're fully taxed. It's an automated system. Government's going to get its money. You have minimal opportunities to cheat. But if you are Donald Trump with 500-plus companies and partnerships, and they're interlocking, and when within themselves there are interlocking partnerships and arrangements, to go after you requires enormous amounts of time. They don't have any time to do that. I mean, I know, for example, about a particular family who transferred $1 billion worth of real estate one day. Mom and dad owned it at 10. They signed some documents at 2 in the afternoon. The children owned it. This a transfer of property should incur a gift tax of $450 million, or if they used very aggressive devices to write it down, it's got to be $100 million. Nobody has $100 million sitting around. Warren Buffett does not have $100 million you can just write a check on. That's not how you do it. And the logical way to do this is the parents take out a loan for $100 million. They pay the gift tax. They give the property to their children, and then children pay off the loan because the interest is tax deductible. They didn't do that, which tells me they didn't file a gift tax return, or if they did, they lied about the value. But, you know, the IRS has done nothing. And I know the IRS knows about this case. I have the same 5-foot stack of documents they have that if no gift tax was filed, these people belong in prison. They are serious, serious criminals. Why is the IRS not pursuing it? Well, I don't know, because the IRS is not allowed to talk about it, but I do know because I've covered them for years. They don't have the resources and the manpower.
They don't have the resources to do this.
Yeah, and the algebra. I mean, literally, a government IRS lawyer would sit down and do the algebra and say, well, this much money, this much time, they'll tie us up for that long. We wouldn't be able to pursue this or that other case over here. We got the government says, Congress says, you got to go after the drug dealers who don't file their taxes first. So they get a free walk. And in this particular case, basically, it means every person in America just got a dollar plus stolen from them by these creeps.
And this is a dynamic, especially the lack of workers within agencies and departments that's happening throughout government. I mean, there is the Scott Pruitts and others that are dismantling their own agency, but then there's just a complete absence.
Well, you know, on the local level, 40 years ago, 45 years ago, I was reading exposés of, you know, children are dying because the child service workers are not doing their job. And there's this person and died on their watch, and then they fire this person. Well, they had caseloads that are 10 times the maximum amount you can handle. The solution to that problem is real simple. You hire more caseworkers. Yeah. It's like the opioid crisis. The Republicans are all saying, well, we need to have treatment centers and we need to go after doctor's licenses. No, you need to go after the manufacturer who's producing 100 times more pills than there's any expectable, reasonable market for. They're no different than drug lords in Colombia. They just have a license. But we go after the wrong things. And in my book, I go through a bunch of the agencies to show here's how your life or your children or grandchildren, your neighbors are being affected. Agency after agency through the stories of what's happened either to people in the agencies or people on the outside.
Is there a story you want to talk about that people may not know about?
Well, one of my favorites in here is Betsy DeVos, born with a platinum spoon in her mouth, marries a guy with two platinum spoons in her mouth, and about whom I'll say one good thing. When she travels as education secretary in her private jet, we don't pay for it. She gives it to us.
Huh.
But she is wants to have corporate and religious education. And the charter schools in Detroit she's involved with are so bad that if you go to someone in the charter school movement and say, well, let's talk about charter schools, and then you say, now let's talk about Detroit. Can we talk about the weather? Can we talk about, let's talk about Stormy Daniels. How about how are those Dodgers going to do next year? Anything but the disaster in Detroit, where literally the charter schools she was involved in are lower performers than the public schools. So she has this student loan crisis, which she knows nothing about. She doesn't lack any money. She has an investment in a student loan debt collection company. It's not material to her wealth, but it's very symbolic. And who does she bring in to fix the student loan debt problem? Why, she brings in executives from the companies that created the problem. This isn't even having the fox guard the hen house, which is in a bunch of agencies we're seeing. This is bringing in the fox to redesign the hen house to maximize how well the foxes are fed. It's just totally outrageous.
Is this any different than what we saw during the Bush administration?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It is.
Yes.
Because we had the same stories, the same dynamic, that you're bringing in the industry to run the departments that are supposed to oversee the industries.
But they were at least bringing in people during that era who, while they were trying to tilt the table in their favor, they weren't trying to first tilt the table and then smash it. And that is what they're doing here. And an example of the callousness of Donald Trump from the tax bill. You've heard Donald Trump say, we love our police. And by the way, it's one of the reasons he got elected. Every campaign, we love you. We love the voters. We love our police. We love our veterans. We love our police.
He used to love the FBI.
Yeah. And so what does the tax bill do? Well, most police officers have to buy their uniforms and their Sam Brown belts and their guns and their bullets and all the other accoutrements. Firefighters have to buy some of their gear. And that was always tax deductible. So was dry cleaning. Not anymore. Not under Donald Trump's bill. You know, take care of ordinary people. Teachers, you want to get an advanced degree so that presumably you'll be a better teacher, yeah, and you will also get a pay raise. Can't deduct tuition and books anymore. Veterans, you know, Donald's always, oh, the veterans, we love the veterans. Now, I pay a lot of attention to this. My father was 100% disabled veteran of World War II. I went to college on the War Orphans Act, because you qualify if you're disabled. You have to be literally an orphan. And they proposed for disabled veterans in certain categories to have their pay cut from $35,000 to $13,000, plunging them into poverty. They wanted to round down the checks. They are trying to do some things to improve the VA, but they're not raising the budget. Why is the VA have all these scandals suddenly? Well, the survival rate in the recent, you know, wars never declared by Congress, but the combat, is dramatically higher than it would have been in World War II, in Korea, even in Vietnam. So guys who get blown up, who would have died in any other time, survive, and they have hellacious medical bills. Well, if we're going to go do things like this, my view is, okay, we decided to go do it. We have an absolute obligation to take care of these guys. And if it costs $1 million a year, the taxpayers should know next time a war is coming, you do this, there are going to be 1,000 vets at $1 million a year each for the next 40 years. You really want to go do this. And we're not taking care of these people. We're not hiring more doctors. We're not really expanding the budget. So the budget of the VA has gone up a lot. But compared to what needed to happen, the VA budget has shrunk significantly. And that's not getting the kind of coverage that it needs.
David K. Johnston, you have been covering Donald Trump for more than 30 years.
Almost 30 years.
Almost 30 years. Okay, so not more, but almost. You've talked to him a number of times. In fact, I read the last time you talked to him is when he called you last year threatening to sue you. I guess it's when he normally calls you. He just called you out of nowhere?
I was writing a piece and I had submitted questions I wanted him to respond to. And he called me at home. This was actually in 2016. And he's done this many, many times. He calls me at home and he starts off. It's a standard Donald Trump phone call. You know, hail fellow well met. How you doing? And then what do you want? And then not answering the questions. And then he says, if I don't like the way you write it, I'm going to sue you. And I said, Donald, you're a public figure. A public figure means he would have to prove that I knew I was lying and I didn't care and I lied anyway. It's called actual malice. Nobody's ever going to prove anything like that about me. And he went, I know I'm a public figure and I don't care. I'm going to sue you anyway. Click. And it's part of his bullying that he does. Now, there are a lot of journalists to whom this would be, I mean, they would induce a lot of concern and fear. They don't do what I do, and I don't expect them to do what I do. To me, it's all right. Donald, you know, once again does this. But, you know, hey.
Because he's done it before.
I don't have to spend a lot of time now giving his explanations and then explaining his explanations to my questions. I just get to lay the stuff out.
So what's that like, though? So he starts off friendly?
Yeah.
Jovial?
Oh, hell fellow, well met. Hey, good to hear from you.
And does it just turn on a dime?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Absolutely. And Donald has used this kind of technique his whole life, that he uses techniques to plant fake news. I mean, it's ironic that Donald Trump talks about fake news. He plants the story that, you know, Kim Basinger and Madonna and Carla Bruni are sleeping with him. Two of them he's never met, and Carla Bruni's called him a lunatic. He got national news coverage. Well, first question in my mind would be, billionaire has affair. Nobody's ever heard of that. I mean, yeah. Wow. You know, billionaire doesn't have mistress strikes me as more likely to be a news story. Years after he does this and gets national news coverage, when you expect journalists should have said, that's not news. He does it again on the Howard Stern radio show where he goes all the time. And if you haven't heard it, don't listen. It's just disgusting, and it's mostly about women's bodies, and he even has a woman co-host, and it's just vile and disgusting. And Howard Stern offers Donald Trump the opportunity to walk it back. He guides him through how to walk it back. Oh, yeah, well, I was just blustered. Not Donald Trump. He doubles down with this flat-out lie, and he actually thinks people will believe that these women, you know, were having affairs with him. More of the Stormy Daniels, who apparently was offered $10,000 for what I thought was one of the great put-downs of all time in the interview she gave to a magazine that didn't originally publish it. She called it textbook sex.
Yeah.
Given that Donald, you know, planted the story that he was basically the greatest lover in America, I thought, what a great put down.
Textbook. Finally, where do you think this all goes? What do you think happens with Donald Trump? And that's an impossible question, and I recognize there's some scenarios. But how does he handle whatever comes?
Well, if Donald Trump serves out two terms and leaves, that's one thing. Let's ignore that possibility. And I certainly hope he doesn't, you know, have a heart attack or a stroke. But I have to tell you, despite what the doctor said, I will not be one bit surprised if we wake up one morning and a guy who never exercises and eats a terrible diet had a stroke. He'll never resign. His ego won't allow him to. I mean, he might have medical condition forced it, and it was obvious he'd be removed if he did.
Be like, I'm tired of this.
Yeah, he can't. No, because Donald believes that, of course, he should be president. But if they try to remove Trump because of the Russians, do we have to remove Mike Pence? And that raises issues because then a Democrat would become president. If they let
if the Democrats have the House.
Well, there'd be no impeachment if the Democrats don't have the House.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. I got you.
Yeah. If they let Mike Pence become president, you'd want to time that carefully. You don't want to impeach and remove Trump too early or too late because you don't want him to have time to build up a reservoir of public support. And remember, this is a guy who it's been reliably reported tells his friends, God put him in this position. Then another possibility is he gets primaried. Mitt Romney or somebody beats him in the primaries. Rigged election, fake votes. It's not true. How do we know that? Look what he said about Hillary. She really lost the election. What if he gets the nomination and loses to someone in the general? Same thing. And once he's out of office.
Can that be dangerous to do that?
I think.
To lose the election and say it was illegitimately taken away from with his supporters? Because maybe not most people believe him, but enough. Hey,
the guy who showed up at the pizza place, Comet Pizza, with the assault rifle, there'd be a lot of people like that if that happens. And Trump, once he's out of office, he'll have no blinders on him. He's not trying to get votes. He will foment violence. I mean, there is no good ending to Trump's departure. But we will get through this, and we'll get to the other side. The question is, how quickly are we going to do it, and are we going to continue to allow a minority party that will not do its constitutional duty and is undermining the national security, because that's what the FBI says about this Nunes memo, to continue to control the process? And if we do, all I got to say to you is, you know, you may say, well, I cast my vote. If you didn't do everything you could to make sure that changes, to find other people, to get them to vote, to call your Aunt Martha, send her my book and say, look, it's all facts. You can look up in the back where it came from. If you didn't do everything you can do, I'm sorry. I just don't have any sympathy for you as we would head towards becoming a fascist state.
And with that, David K. Johnston, thank you.
Thank you, Mitch.
Again, David K. Johnston has been our guest. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist. His latest book is called It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Daniel Ellsberg, The Doomsday Machine. Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. In 1969, Daniel Ellsberg secretly copied the plans for the United States-Vietnam relations, later to be published as the Pentagon Papers. What was not known widely until late 2017 is that Ellsberg also copied the top-secret plans for nuclear war that he consulted on for the Department of Defense and drafted for Secretary Robert McNamara. Some of these papers, along with his first-person report of the history of nuclear war planning, have now finally been published to high acclaim under the title The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. The publication comes at an extraordinarily auspicious and dangerous time, as nuclear tensions are mounting and the U.S. president is challenging North Korea. When the new Ellsberg book appeared in print in late 2017, a related event took place in Oslo, Norway. ICAN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, received the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize. ICAN was honored in recognition of their efforts, quote, to draw attention to the catastrophic humanitarian consequences of any use of nuclear weapons, end quote. ICAN is a coalition of non-governmental organizations in 100 countries. They're promoting the implementation of the United Nations Nuclear Weapons Ban Treaty. This landmark global agreement was voted on in New York City on July 7, 2017. It will enter into legal force once 50 nations have signed and ratified it. This new international agreement places nuclear weapons on the same legal footing as other weapons of mass destruction, which have long been outlawed. Two women accepted the award for ICAN, Executive Director Beatrice Finn and Setsuko Thurlow, a survivor of the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima in 1945. Here's a short clip with Beatrice Finn.
Nobel laureate William Faulkner said when accepting his prize in 1950, there is only the question of, when will I be blown up? But since then, this universal fear has given way to something even more dangerous, denial. Gone is the fear of Armageddon in an instant. Gone is the equilibrium between two blocks that was used as a justification for deterrence. Gone are the fallout shelters. But one thing remains, the thousands upon thousands of nuclear warheads that filled us up with that fear. The risk of nuclear weapons use is even greater today than at the end of the Cold War. But unlike the Cold War, today we face many more nuclear armed states, terrorists, cyber warfare. All of this makes us less safe. As the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear Wars, the first ever anti-nuclear weapons organization to win this prize, said on this stage in 1985, "We physicians protest the outrage of holding the entire world hostage. We protest the moral obscenity that each of us is being continuously targeted for extinction." And those words ring true still today. We must reclaim the freedom to not live our lives as hostages to imminent destruction. Man, not woman, made nuclear weapons to control others, but instead we are controlled by them.
That was Beatrice Finn, Executive Director of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN. Setsuko Thurlow survived the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima in 1945 as a 13-year-old child.
Today, I want you to feel in this hall the presence of all those who perished in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I want you to feel above and around a great cloud of 250,000 souls. Each person had a name. Each person was loved by someone. Let us ensure that their deaths were not in vain. I was just 13 years old girl when the United States dropped the first atomic bomb on my city of Hiroshima. I remember that morning vividly. At 8:15, I saw a blinding bluish-white flash. I remember having the sensation of floating in the air. When I regained the consciousness in the total darkness and silence, I found myself pinned under the collapsed building. I knew I was faced with death. I began hearing faint voices of my classmates around me. Mother, help me. God, help me. Then all of a sudden, somebody shook my left shoulder from behind. The man saying, don't give up, keep pushing, keep kicking. You see the sun ray coming through that opening. Crawl toward it as quickly as possible. As I crawled out, the rubble was on fire. Most of my classmates in the same building were burnt alive. I saw all around me utter unrecognizable, unimaginable devastation. Procession of ghostly figures shuffled by. Wounded people, they were bleeding, burned, blackened, and swollen. Parts of their bodies were missing. Flesh and skin hung from their bones. Some with their own eyeballs hanging in their hands. Some with their bellies burst open, their intestines hanging out. The foul stench of burnt human flesh filled the air. Thus, with one bomb, my beloved city was obliterated.
That was Setsuko Thurlow. She now lives in Canada and has worked for decades as a social worker in Toronto, serving Japanese-speaking immigrants. Daniel Ellsberg is currently on tour for his most recent book, The Doomsday Machine. Even though the book is in large measure a memoir, Ellsberg is always being asked questions about the nuclear threats of the day, North Korea, and President Trump's public announcements about fire, fury, and total destruction. Ellsberg spoke at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco on December 12, 2017. He was being interviewed by Dr. Gloria Duffy, president and CEO of the club.
Tell us about 1961, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Bob Comer, showed you a graph about the expected casualties from a nuclear war.
I drafted a question that was sent to the Joint Chiefs by my friend Bob Comer, who was the assistant to McGeorge Bundy, the deputy to McGeorge Bundy, as assistant to the president for national security, in the name of the president, Kennedy. And the question was, which I had the impression they didn't have an answer to and would be embarrassed by not knowing the answer. The question was, if your plans were carried out as planned, and that meant, first, initiating not a preventive war, we've always ruled that out, not a Pearl Harbor out of the blue where there's no expectation that they're about to attack us. That was ruled out by Eisenhower and everybody else. But an initiation of strategic strikes against the homeland of the Soviet Union, in the case, say, of a crisis arising in Europe, Berlin crisis, 1961, or in 58 under Eisenhower, or if the Soviets went into Iran. Eisenhower believed, plausibly, that any fighting with Soviet troops would escalate to nuclear war. Better that we do it first, you know, and do what we could to wipe out their forces. So there was no plan for limited war with the Soviet Union. And there was another peculiarity of the plans under Eisenhower. In the case of any conflict with the Soviet Union anywhere, whether it was Iran, Berlin, an uprising in East Europe, which is always a possibility, we would hit not only every city in Russia and the USSR, but every city in China. Now, there was a Sino-Soviet bloc, supposedly, in the 50s, but it had been, as you know, eroding very much in the late 50s. And by 61, 60, it was really quite a split. But only some people in the government were prepared to recognize that at that point. And the plans called for hitting the entire Sino-Soviet bloc under any circumstances of armed conflict with Russians anywhere. Okay. So the question then was, if your plans against the Sino-Soviet bloc are carried out under any circumstances, how many will be killed? And the answer came, well, you asked me about a graph. The answer came in two parts, in a way. First was a chart, a very simple chart, which I reproduce in the book, very simple to remember, unforgettable, I'm sorry to say, of vertical axis, millions of deaths. And on the horizontal axis, months with fallout, as months proceeded and the fallout is spread, how many will die? And there was a simple line, obviously a simple linear model. And the lowest number, which was given to the president right away, top secret, eyes only for the president, and I was seeing it because I'd written the question, so Comer showed it to me. The lowest number was 275 million people, going up to 325 million, my question had been, I should say, in the USSR and China alone. My reaction was, this is the most evil plan that has ever existed. It's insane. How could this be the case? And it was not a hypothetical construct of some sort, a model for thinking about that we used to do at RAND. This was the operational plan for the United States forces in the year of a Berlin crisis. They did know the answer, it turned out. So I said, okay, how many altogether then? Not just USSR and China. And within a week, we got a table with the rest of it. Another 100 million in East Europe, the satellite countries, the prisoner countries, we called them. 100 million of them would be killed. Another 100 million in West Europe, our allies, subject to Khrushchev by medium-range missiles, short-range missiles that we could not find or locate. There was no chance, hundreds of them. Just as North Korea holds South Korea, total hostage. We can't eliminate that by any attack. And Japan as well, okay? Okay, our allies would be annihilated then by fallout from our own attack. Not counting the Russian attack, which was certain to kill them, but the fallout from our attacks without a single warhead landing over there would kill them depending on which, quote, which way the wind blew. Depended on season and the weather. A third 100 million, roughly, in areas contiguous to the Soviet Union and China. Afghanistan, a place I hardly knew, I couldn't have located on a map then. Austria. Finland. We would wipe out Finland without a single warhead landing on Finland by fallout from our attacks on the submarine pens at Leningrad. Japan, northern India, so forth. Another 100 million, all those. A total of 600 million. Hard to imagine, hard to visualize, but 100 holocausts. And even if this was retaliation, which it wasn't, it was a first strike, astoundingly. But even as retaliation, you're talking not about retaliatory genocide, you're talking about retaliatory multi-genocide. And although at that time the Russians were believed to have hundreds of missiles, more than we could find, oddly, the Joint Chiefs that summer told Kennedy that if we had to go first over Berlin, they thought they could tell him that at most there would be 10 million deaths in the United States only. And that's, I discussed that in the book. That seemed a very odd estimate, you know, because how could it be that low? But the fact that those deaths would be over there, as Senator Lindsey Graham is telling us now about North Korea and war with North Korea, here's Senator Lindsey Graham say, President Trump has said to me face-to-face, and I agree with him, the casualties if we attack North Korea will be over there. That's a direct quote. Thousands of deaths, yes, our allies in South Korea, but not over here. Well, it's the same calculation, and Kim Jong-un thinks I have to have an ICBM to make this more obvious that the casualties will be over here as well. But strictly speaking, he doesn't need an ICBM. He's got boats, and they don't get here in 30 minutes, but they get here in less than 30 days, and he has lots of warheads he can put on a boat and send to Long Beach Harbor or San Francisco and blow up this. And RAND Corporation, our old corporation, made a study of this in 2006, the year that North Korea first exploded a weapon. And they said 65,000 dead immediately, but 250,000 more dead with radioactivity in a little while. So Graham would be wrong. You know, nobody's perfect. He'd make a mistake. They're not all over there. But the casualties that are over there would be not numbered in hundreds of millions, but millions in a day or a week. And the human species has never seen violence that big, that fast, ever. It would be more violence in a day or a week than in human history. It's mad. It's crazy that the world is standing by passively and allowing this to be risked and gambled and asked, will he or won't he? We're all watching to see, you know, what will happen when a disaster is being prepared. And that's what I was looking at in 61 that you talk about, but on a scale of 1,000 times greater, 1,000 times greater. We're talking of billions of people, not millions. And that has been true ever since when it comes to war with Russia. By the way, it isn't only Americans. The Russians this week are playing games in Iraq, close to our planes. They're going the wrong side of the Euphrates and interfering with our planes, trying to say, yes, we are, you know, you can't fool with us, and so forth. So once again, we're finding a games of chicken going on, as during the Cuban Missile Crisis, that with Russia threaten, as I say, not millions, but billions. And one thing I think that people are rightly worried about in the case of North Korea, but they haven't defined it just like this. As you know from my book, I've said Trump is not the first to be making nuclear threats. In fact, he's not even the first to make nuclear threats against Korea. The first was when I was 19 in 1950. I was waiting to go to Korea at that point. Harry Truman made those threats in 1950. But North Korea didn't have nuclear weapons then. No president has made a threat of nuclear weapons against the nuclear weapon state for 55 years. That was the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, where the scale was much greater. But we haven't had a threat like this against the nuclear weapon state ever since. It's crazy for either side to think of armed conflict with the other. But both sides are threatening crazy action, and anyone who says there's no chance that that'll be carried out has not been following any of the events here. So we are in a very serious situation.
So the elements of our nuclear policy and strategy are relatively similar to what they were 50 years ago. Where should we go from here? Deterrence, arms control, et cetera. What's the hope now?
I've never felt that there was no merit whatever, on the contrary, to the notion of deterrence in the sense of having a capability to retaliate to a nuclear attack with nuclear weapons. Granted, we started out in the late 40s as a monopolist of nuclear weapons. We weren't deterring nuclear attack. We were the only ones who could commit a nuclear attack. And then when the Russians acquired that capability, we continued to defend Europe, supposedly, by a willingness to attack first, which meant a willingness to not blow the world up because we didn't know about nuclear winter then that threatens the entire world. We haven't really talked about that. But a third of the population of the world, a billion people being killed by the Joint Chiefs estimate at a time when the world population was 3 billion. That was in 1961. So they didn't know about the nuclear winter, but they knew that they were threatening one-third, and they were willing to risk that and even prepared to carry it out. That was never justified. It was never necessary. It has never been in any remote way justified. And it's true, you can't uninvent nuclear weapons, but you can dismantle doomsday machines that we now know would kill everybody or kill a third. By the way, India and Pakistan alone can cause starvation by their attacks with their much, much smaller forces of a third of the world's population. Now, the population of 7 billion. They have no right to risk that over Kashmir or any other purpose. How could they possibly have a right to have such a capability? Ours is 100 times greater and not justified. So, as former Defense Secretary Perry has laid out an agenda, eliminating the ICBMs, the land-based vulnerable missiles, which really are for nothing other than first strike or preemptive strike, because they can't survive an enemy first strike. They're only good if you get them off the ground, use them or lose them. Those should not exist on either side. But we would be safer if we just got rid of ours right away, eliminate the so-called land-based leg. No first use? Yes. It should not be on the table in our bargaining. That doesn't mean that that threat can't work. But in order to make it credible, we build weapons that can end life on Earth, essentially. We don't need that. We shouldn't have that and so forth. So it isn't enough just to declare no first use, which would be an enormous change in our policy. But by itself would not necessarily affect much, but we should get rid of the weapons for first use. We should demonstrate we have no intention of doing this. Get rid of the weapons in Europe, as Germany has wanted to do for over 20 years. Or I don't say they do at this moment because of the various crises coming up, but really Germany back in the 90s was calling for no first use, and Madeleine Albright said, no way. The U.S. doesn't go along with that. But the people who right now are saying, no, we want first use threats, are the Poles, on now part of NATO, on the border of Russia. Now, they even want our weapons based in Poland, which so far we have kept up with our agreement not to do that. That could change under Trump. I wouldn't be surprised. Or they want their own nuclear weapons, if not ours. What is the threat they're making? Do they want to be occupied? Of course not. But if they use those weapons, what they're threatening is triggering omnicide. And they're not the first to do that. That's the NATO. That's the old NATO threat. But it was never justified. It should not be made. Same for the Baltics. We should cut down the number, in my opinion, this would be controversial, of the sub-launched missiles and submarines. We don't need 14. We don't need 10. Trident submarines out there. They are invulnerable, but we have hundreds of missiles that threaten their land-based missiles and encourage them to launch on warning, on a full thing. That makes the world vulnerable. I would say no country has the right to have the capability to commit omnicide. Cut that down. And is that possible? Well, politically, not this year. Not with this Congress, not with this president, and frankly, not with the last Congress and not with the last president either, or any of them. It would take a new set of standards, mm-hmm. a new norm in a way that you should not have the ability to destroy life. It seems a modest goal in some sense, and yet an enormous change.
That was Daniel Ellsberg, interviewed by Dr. Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco on December 12, 2017. Ellsberg spoke about his new book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. In 1961, he consulted for the Department of Defense and the White House and drafted Secretary Robert McNamara's plans for nuclear war. And of course, he is the author of the Pentagon Papers. The former high-level defense analyst, Daniel Ellsberg, revered this shocking first-hand account of America's nuclear war program in the 1960s. From the remotest air bases in the Pacific Command to the secret plans for general nuclear war under Eisenhower. If executed, these plans would have caused the near extinction of humanity. Ellsberg shows that the legacy of this most dangerous arms buildup in the history of civilization and its proposed renewal under the Trump administration threatens our very survival. No other insider with high-level access has written so candidly on the nuclear strategy of the late Eisenhower and early Kennedy years. And nothing has fundamentally changed since that era. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
To Latin Waves with your hosts Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
They aren't new inventions that are necessary. It's simply organizing and creating the political will to win those reforms at the same time that we are increasing people's confidence in the fact that we actually know how to run a system. We don't need capitalism anymore. In the end, we don't need it anymore because it doesn't serve our interests as well as a participatory, democratic, socialist economy would.
That's the voice of economist Dr. Robin Hanel. In this week's show, we speak to Dr. Hanel about minimum basic income and many ways forward regarding the economy. So stay tuned.
You are listening to Latin Waves. I'm your host, Sylvia Richardson. I'm very privileged this morning to be joined by Dr. Robin Hanel. He's a professor emeritus from American University in Washington, where he has taught for over 30 years. He's most known for his prolific writing. Some of his co-creations have been with author Michael Albert on the alternatives to capitalism. He's also worked with Aaron Olin Wright. And I'm very privileged today to be talking about his book, his latest book with Eric Olin Wright, Alternatives to Capitalism. Welcome to our show, Robin.
Good to be with you, Sylvia.
Now, in previous interviews, we have talked about and economics of the people. So your book was Of the People, By the People, The Case for a Participatory Economy. And now we are, I think, at the stage where we really want to describe what the elephant in the room is, and is that capitalism isn't working. So what is an alternative to capitalism? Many people are talking about universal basic income. Perhaps there is an idea of a complete socialism. What are we talking about?
I mean, I think it's important for people to realize there's two different questions. One is capitalism with a different economic system. If we really expect to solve our economic problems, if we really expect to achieve economic justice, economic democracy, environmental sustainability, et cetera. And I've long argued, along with many, many socialists for many, many years, that we eventually need to replace capitalism with some form of participatory, ecologically sound socialism. But that's a way in the future. And in the present, we need to search for programs that will improve outcomes and also move us in the direction of eventually replacing capitalism with a far better economic system. And one of the new ideas that the left and progressives have, you know, are discussing in not only the United States, Canada, but in Europe as well, is something called a universal basic income. And this is a very interesting idea. It shouldn't be confused with replacing capitalism with socialism. It is what I would call an economic reform that, if done well, would improve outcomes. It would essentially make outcomes somewhat more equitable within capitalism. So in that context, it needs to be sort of analyzed or compared with other strategies for improving, you know, income distribution in capitalism. Ones that we've talked about and the left has worked for in the past, such as organizing unions, which will win better wages, or such as living wage campaigns that are local, or such as campaigns for raising, you know, the national minimum wage. So people should understand that universal basic income is a different policy than the ones I just mentioned, but it's aimed at the same thing, which is doing something in the here and now that's effective about stemming the escalating inequality that neoliberal capitalism has unleashed.
I think that it's really important to talk about what an economy is and what it is supposed to do, because the reason it's so naturalized that the only way we can create an economy is capitalism is because most people don't understand what exactly the economy is.
For most people, there is no alternative to capitalism. They think capitalism is what economics is. That's one of the things we struggle against. And then a second problem that eventually has to be overcome is anybody who thinks there might be an alternative to capitalism, they assume it was 20th century Soviet socialism. And that's not what any of us, you know, are proposing anymore. But a universal basic income is a policy that ordinary people can understand, and it's really quite simple. It says that the government will give every member of society a certain income, no questions asked. It simply comes as a monthly check, or it can come at the beginning of the year. I'll describe one proposal because it's easier to understand that way. So we could have a universal basic income in the United States where every adult over the age of 18 gets $1,000 a month, and every child under the age of 18 gets $500 a month. That would be for, I hesitate to call it a tip. We used to call this a typical family of four. And of course, there are fewer and fewer typical families. But two adults and two children, you know, that would be an income that would be $3,000 a month. And that would be $36,000 a year. Now, that's about 150% of the poverty income for a family of four in the United States. So that would mean that that income that comes, no questions asked, to absolutely everybody would put everybody above the poverty line, considerably above what's called the poverty line. Well, that's a huge benefit in terms of combating poverty. It's also a huge improvement in terms of income distribution. Now, the question comes, well, where does all this money come from? Because that is roughly 20% of gross domestic product. Where is that going to come from? Well, you're going to have to, essentially, you have to raise that amount of money in taxes. How could you do it? Well, it turns out you could raise it in the following way, which would be a good way to do it. Don't raise anybody's taxes who is above the median income. So the bottom 50% of the population, you don't raise taxes from them one iota to pay for this. Only people above the top half would have their taxes go up. Now, everybody above the top half would have their taxes go up. If you do it in a progressive way, and if you also taxed 2% of wealth for the top 1% of wealth earners, it turns out that the bottom 50% have no increase in taxes. The next 40% from the middle up toward the top, they would get more in the universal basic income than their taxes would rise. So they would be better off. And only the top 20% and the top 1% of wealth earners would have taxes that were larger than the universal basic income they were receiving. Now, that would be a wonderful policy. So would unionizing the entire workforce. So would raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. So the question is this a better thing to fight for? Is it more politically feasible? And those are the things that people are discussing at this point.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, because I just heard a report recently that the top 1%, mainly inheritance money, you know, it's not something they're producing. It's not some, an item, some kind of contribution that they're making that goes. Simply you inherit it. You were born with it and now you have this money. So can we talk about this, how this taxation would then sprinkle, because what we're hearing instead is the idea of a flat tax, the idea of increasing taxes that, you know, it seems like they would be a better choice because they're lower in taxes. But what's the difference between a flat tax and one that taxes, for instance, the inheritance of that 1%?
You know, in Canada, I think the populace is a little more sensible about taxation in Canada than it is in the United States. I don't think there's any country on the planet where the population is more confused and engages in more self-inflicted wounds in terms of how they vote and respond to the word tax. A flat tax, as it's commonly used, is everybody pays the same percentage of their income in taxes. So if you earn $20,000 a year, you pay 10% of that in taxes. If you earn $2 million a year, you pay 10% of that in taxes. That's what people call a flat tax. It's basically an economist would more carefully describe it as a proportional tax. Everybody pays the same proportion of their income, in my example, 10%, in taxes. One reaction to that is, well, that's remarkably fair. I mean, everybody's paying the same proportion. On the other hand, it's not remarkably fair if the original distribution of income was unfair in the first place. If the people in the top end, if they deserve less of their millions of dollars of income than people in the bottom end, then proportional taxation simply recreates whatever economic injustice was there in the first place. So if you want a tax system that will at least ameliorate the economic injustice that the labor and capital market create when they distribute income in the first place, then the tax system has to be what's called progressive. You have to take a higher percentage of high-income people's taxes and a lower percentage of low-income people's taxes. So That's what's at stake. Anybody who's a progressive, who's fighting for progressive ways to ameliorate escalating income inequality, we need to fight for progressive taxes rather than flat taxes or proportional taxes. And we need to identify all the taxes that are actually existing, which are actually regressive. They end up taking a higher percentage of low-income people's incomes than they take of high-income people's incomes. And the principal tax that does that is a sales tax. Sales taxes are notoriously regressive. They actually take a higher percentage of low-income people's income than they do high-income people's income.
What prevents us from creating this basic universal income project, and you know, that clearly will lift people? Because in the past we've told every high tide lifts all boats, but as Noam Chomsky says, you know, some high tides sink boats, right? And a lot of these high income waves have only benefited very few people. So what's preventing us from creating this now?
Well, okay. I mean, the debate that goes on over a UBI, one is a question of practicality, which is, if we prioritize a fight for a UBI and we put our time, energy, and political clout into a campaign for that, are we likely to be more successful than if we try and pour time, an equal amount of time and energy into union organizing or into fighting for raising the minimum wage? The UBI, I mean, it's not a miracle cure. It's just one way to reduce economic injustice in capitalism. I mean, the other thing we could do is we could fight harder to better and more adequately fund our present poverty programs. So why is it that people are talking about this instead of talking about all sorts of other things that we used to do to try and address both poverty and income inequality? I think the answer to that is, well, there's been a change in circumstances. Unions are incredibly weak. What if they continue to be incredibly weak? Well, 10 years ago, progressives started working on some rather successful local campaigns for living wages. In metropolitan areas where there was a progressive voting population and you could affect city government, then you would try and pass living wage ordinances. And we did that successfully. Well, why did we do that instead of fighting to raise the national minimum wage? Well, because we didn't have enough political clout in Congress to do that. So this should simply be viewed as, in present political circumstances, are we more likely to make headway and progress trying to fight for a UBI than some of the old things we did? And I don't know if the answer to that is yes or no. One thing to consider is this, and this has come up in the past also. There's a difference between a universal basic income and a basic income. Universal basic income means you give everybody, every adult over 18, for example, $1,000. Well, wait a minute. That means you give the millionaires an extra $1,000. That's what universal means. Oh, well, why would we do that? Why wouldn't we just give people who need it this basic income? Well, that's a basic income, and it's different from a universal basic income. And there's an argument for doing that. It's the same as the argument for giving people who don't need Social Security when they retire Social Security, and that is, you get more political support if it's universal. On the other hand, the taxes you have to raise to pay the extra money to the people who don't need it because you made a basic income universal, that means you do have to raise the extra taxes to give the wealthy their $1,000 a month. So this is something that's discussed amongst people. Do you want it to really just be a basic income for people who need it, or do you want it to be a universal basic income? The other thing that I think is very important for progressives to think about is whether or not this would be resented. Suppose you're hardworking. Both adults in the family are working at low-income jobs. They're barely making it. Now, they get their universal basic income, but so do people who aren't working at all. And are you going to have resentment on the part of the hardworking poor that people who are not, in their view, hardworking, but could be or should be, are getting this basic income also? And I'm quite concerned with that. That's a political issue that progressives do need to think seriously about.
You're listening to an interview with Dr. Robin Hinnell on Latin Waves. For more information on Latin Waves or to hear previous episodes, go to www.latinwavesmedia.com. And now back to our interview with Dr. Robin Hinnell.
I want to intercede there because as long as we have an economy that relies on markets and relies on a divergence of income stratas, right? So as long as we have an economically poor sector of the population, you are going to have unemployment, and that's the reality. So I don't think the resentment argument is that hard to overcome, because literally if we had zero employment, then you could argue that, you know, everyone could potentially have a useful job. But many of the people who have the highest gross income, and I mean gross in every sense of the word, do not make anything. You know, they inherited that money. They're sitting on money that they never work or will work for. So I don't think that argument is a very hard one to overcome. What I do think we need to talk about is the point you made earlier about the strength of a union. Because unions not only ensure that people have livable wages, you know, jobs with dignity and justice, I would say activate our sense of empathy and care for one another. It's about safety. It's about dignity. It's about wages. It's about, you know, the health of the entire community. So can we talk a little bit about the process that having a universal basic income would create and how it would allow us to have more space, more time to organize, to co-create this vision of a more just society?
I think you're focusing on important things that progressives need to weigh. On the one hand, and everything you said I think is completely correct, what unions say is our people are doing hard, they are making sacrifices to do socially useful things. And they deserve to be rewarded for those sacrifices that they are making, because sacrifices are necessary if we're to have useful things, useful goods and services. A universal basic income says, basically, our society is wealthy enough. All of us together, when we work, are wealthy enough so that we can afford to give everybody at least this much. We no longer have to have anybody living in poverty. Now, in some sense, I think that's a very good message. We are collectively wealthy enough. Our technology and resources and productive economic capabilities and advanced economies have reached the point where there is no reason anybody should live in poverty. That's a positive message. On the other hand, if you're hardworking, how do you feel about people who choose not to, if you believe that's what they would do, and still have this basic income? So that resentment factor, I think, is a problem. The whole idea that there is dignity in doing socially useful work, which is essentially the union message, I don't think that is a message that comes from universal basic income. It's, well, as citizens in a wealthy economy, we have a right not to live in poverty. We have a right to live 150% above the poverty line. That's essentially what the universal basic income I described. I mean, there are all sorts of other problems with universal basic income, which is the one I described would be well worth winning. Well, if it turns out that what you're going to get is something that is a cheap version of universal basic income, and you only get it because you politically concede that you are no longer going to have a whole bunch of welfare programs, well, then you could end up worse off than you started. You could essentially have been tricked into fighting for a reform that it wasn't a generous one. It wasn't financed through progressive taxations. It still leaves people below poverty lines. And in fact, it was used as an excuse to get rid of all sorts of other anti-poverty programs that we've had in the past that the right wing is always trying to convince us to eliminate. So those are just a host of practical situations. My own attitude toward the universal basic income is I understand why people are looking for a new tool. They need to understand what this tool is and what its pros and cons are. In the end, you have to decide, are we going to make more progress toward our end of reducing income inequality this way as opposed to other ways that we have at our disposal?
Can you say more about how this tool can be used against us to eradicate social systems? Like, would this mean because we get a universal basic income, you no longer get funded healthcare, you no longer get funded housing projects? Is that what you're talking about?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. And it would be very foolish for us not to understand that that would be the nature of the political battle that we would be fighting if we put time and energy into fighting for a universal basic income. In the end, what we win is always a question of our political power compared to our opponents. Just because we decide to fight for a universal basic income, I mean, we fight for unionization. We've been losing. We could fight for universal basic income, and we could lose in that fight as well, if we didn't increase our overall power, you know, in terms of our opponents.
Whether we see these challenges ahead, it's important that we go with clear eyes. And I think that what you're saying is very wise. You know, we want to fight for tools that allow us to lift people out of poverty. We want to create tools that create a more democratic redistribution of wealth that is co-created by people's labor and, you know, sacrifices. And we want to create a world where we are also offering other forms of contribution, where art, where music, where activities, people who help people stay healthy and active are also valued as worthy, you know, work to be completed. So in many ways, I think we're fighting not just for the right to have work that pays us with dignity, but also for the right to envision a society without injustice, without inequality. And I think that's really where we're going. So as we move closer to the end of our interview, I wonder if you could tell me what inspires you these days. I know you've been very active with some movements, the Job with Justice movement and Rising Tide. Can you talk a little bit about what inspires you and, you know, and makes you believe we can do this? We can. After all, you did write the book, Participatory Democracy. Economic systems do exist in your imagination and in practice. They already exist.
My overall view is that, first, human beings are perfectly capable of managing and running an economy that is far superior to any version of capitalism. That is increasingly apparent the more we see how capitalism works and the more we understand what a, you know, how it is that a participatory system of planning and taking environmental consequences into account is well within humanity's grasp. At the same time, this isn't going to happen overnight. The other thing that's increasingly apparent is that there are better and worse forms of capitalism, that neoliberal capitalism is much, much worse than what we used to in the 20th century call social democratic capitalism. So we know that capitalism with strong unions that represent a majority of employees is a much better economy than capitalism in which unions have been, you know, eviscerated, which is literally what's happened in the United States. We know that capitalism that has welfare programs for people who, through no fault of their own, fall between the cracks in the competitions, in the economics of competition and greed, is a far better form of capitalism. What we're talking about now is, well, what are those programs that we could use now in the here and now to diminish the damage that neoliberal capitalism is unleashing on the planet and the entire bottom half of the income distribution? What can we do in the here and now? And there are tools, and a universal basic income is one, unionization is one, minimum wages is one, welfare programs is one, financial regulation is one. All of these things are, they're not rocket science. They aren't new inventions that are necessary. It's simply organizing and creating the political will to win those reforms at the same time that we are increasing people's confidence in the fact that we actually know how to run a system. We don't need capitalism anymore. In the end, we don't need it anymore because it doesn't serve our interests as well as a participatory, democratic, socialist economy would. Those are two different battles we have to be waging. We've been losing both. We have to wage them at the same time. You don't have to do one rather than the other. I think we have to do them simultaneously, and the coming generation has to be more successful than, unfortunately, my generation was.
Thank you so much for that. You are a wonderful economist and one that speaks to my heart. I think a society that is well-informed is a society that is stronger for it.
Well, thank you again, Sylvia, and I'm sure we'll talk again in the near future.
Take care. Thanks again.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.